How many of you know that George Washington was a Freemason? How many of you know if you're a Freemason, you cannot possibly in your wildest dreams be a Christian? It's absolutely impossible. And I can show it to you in their own words. So how could George Washington be a Christian? And you don't even know the slightest, teeniest bit about his real involvement in the secret societies. He founded a military order, a secret order of his military officers, the generals and senior officers of the revolution. What's the name of that order? The Knights? Of Cincinnati. Also known as the Knights of the Golden Circle. What sprang out of the Knights of the Golden Circle many years later? The Ku Klux Klan. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin was in the colonies, he pretended to be a pious Christian, although he was not seen in church too much, pretended to be a pious Christian. However, he entered into a sexual relationship and a living arrangement with two different women and sired children by both of them, never married either one. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin went to France, he surrounded himself with prostitutes and drank champagne almost 24 hours a day? And just reveled in orgies. How many of you knew that? You'd be surprised what some ugly old men are capable of. See, these are things you don't know because you were taught something different, and it makes you uncomfortable to hear what I'm telling you, only for the reason that you've been taught something else and you've been reared with it and you've accepted it. It's hard to let go of something that you have learned and accepted that is not true. You don't want to let go of it, because then you have to give up your comfort zone.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 23rd of August, 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, which, with London's Inner Temple, is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora, not Google Play, and I'm pleased to say I've managed finally to just disable my Google Play, so it's not asking me for my fingerprints and my biometric eyeball scans, and so I can still download those nice apps using Aurora. You have to download Aurora and then you can just disable Google Play. You can get everything pretty much on there. I imagine there are some that Google won't allow on Aurora. I'm not sure, but anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions and puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, these so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months, twisted Armageddonist and accelerationist policies craftily crafted to make every crisis worse. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their financial system. Albert Pike's World War III slugfest relies on your blind obedience, by the way. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS through their latest glove puppet with panda-eyed energy saboteur secretary we're going to hear from this week. I did say that a few weeks ago, and we didn't, but we are this week, hopefully. Ed Miliband helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF's Fourth Reich matrix. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers back here in the studio. Nice to see you, Martin. Hello. Now, first of all, your take on this big story of the week, which is this yacht. Have you seen anything about that? That's
Well, I have, obviously. I'm not really picked up. I mean, I know that this guy is quite an important billionaire tech person, but that's all I've picked up on, really.
There's two powerful people that have both been killed, aren't there, in this tragic accident, in big inverted commas. One is also the president of Morgan Stanley.
Well, that may be so. But obviously, I have been reading a lot this week about stuff that's going on, but I've not really been looking into
I
don't see how political this is as we
know. Well, it's financial. I would say it's financial. It's also tech, which is in its own way political. So the reason I'm particularly interested in it is the fact that you've got the mainstream press have gone very, very big on it, and I think, even though they haven't actually said it, that's because they think that there's some this is an assassination of some sort. This guy spent 12 years going through the courts in the United States with him trying to destroy him. Finally, he was exonerated, and on his little celebration tour, he's a dead man.
Well, that may be so, Tony, but as you say, the mainstream media have been going on and on about this week, and that's the sort of stuff I generally avoid.
So did CIA do assassinations? Don't they? The Mafia do assassinations. It was just off of Sicily.
Yes, well, it might be an assassination, but until evidence really starts coming out that it is, I'm not necessarily...
Well, there is evidence, because they've started a police inquiry now into the fact that they believe it's an... I mean, one of the things that amazes me, I was chatting to some, I won't say who it was, but a lefty person yesterday, saying, oh, what do you think about this? Oh, no, it's definitely not an assassination. It was a giant tornado whirlwind hit the ship.
Well, apparently there was bad sea conditions, so there you go.
Anyway, Politico don't agree with you. Mike Lynch, they say, missing tycoons' ties to UK spy chiefs. The serial entrepreneurs' business ventures are entangled in the worlds of both UK and US intelligence, they say. It was a freak yachting accident that grips the world. Or was it? And the disappearance of British tech tycoon Mike Lynch in stormy seas off the coast of Sicily was made even stranger by the fact that 2 days earlier, his business partner, Stephen Chamberlain, was fatally injured in a car accident in Cambridge while he was jogging. A car hit him and killed him. Long-standing business associates, the pair were tried as co-defendants in the fraud trial over the sale of software company Autonomy to Hewlett-Packard for $11 billion. That's about £7 billion. Following the sale of Autonomy in 2011, Lynch co-founded the cybersecurity firm Darktrace, and Chamberlain was appointed chief financial officer. The Cambridge-based company fights cyber attacks using software that learns the behavioural patterns of every actor within an organisation and detects unusual activity. There's nothing so far to indicate foul play, although there is, as of today, Politico. Adding to the intrigue, however, the business partners' ties to the world's UK and US intelligence. Lynch co-founded Darktrace in partnership with UK intelligence officials in 2013. One of the co-founders was Stephen Huxter, high-ranking figure in MI5 cyber defence team. So there's some clear links to this piece of software. Seems as if it's quite smart. It's actually watching what people are doing, and it's quite good at stopping cyber attacks. So maybe, Martin, somebody would like ownership of that software.
Well, I mean, you've got to have means, motive and opportunity if there are foul play here. And if he's embedded in the British security services, well, they've got their enemies, haven't they?
Well, maybe he's a little bit too close for comfort, this chap. And also, of course, there is competition in the United States. I mean, he's taken a court in the States. It may be that the Americans are just rather annoyed that we've got this I mean, of course, when he sold this company, he's suddenly a very, very wealthy man, and he can start to invest. So he could potentially be a threat to the US if he's not necessarily on side with the CIA, maybe a bit closer to Britain and British interests.
Well, that's a theory, Tony, but it might be the Russians, because the Russians hate both the British and the Americans, and they've got much more of a motive, surely.
No, I don't think so. No, I think the Americans are quite happy about taking out their own so-called Nord Stream pipeline friends of the Germans and the Swiss, actually, that own that, rather than... I mean, they're trying to control their empire, it seems to me, the Americans, and this, to me, has got all the hallmarks of an assassination rather than just some freak accident. I mean, even the people who were down there were saying it was very strange that the boat hadn't been given information to come into port before the storm, and secondly, that so many people died on the boat at the same time, that normally, you know, in any kind of difficult situation, there are life jackets, life rafts and things like that, and they could get out, but they weren't. They were all trapped inside still for some reason.
Well, I mean, I can hear what you're saying, Tony. You've obviously looked into this in more detail than
I have. Not that much. I've just read a couple of articles. But, I mean, it's also... you talk about your copper's instinct sometimes. This is my copper's instinct telling me tech giant, Brit, not necessarily liked by the United States, manages to get off a court case where the US are taking him to task. 12 years in court, he manages to get off, and somehow he's now fine for 5 minutes, and then he's dead.
Yes, well, I can hear what you're saying, but obviously the ship sank and not everybody on the ship was killed. He was, but that, you know, how can you predict who's going to die when you sink a ship? Some people die, some people don't. He might have survived. I don't know, Tony. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm not opposed to saying there's possible theories.
Well, you could have Navy divers around bumping certain people off and not others, potentially. You could. There's all sorts of ways you can control who dies and who doesn't in a so-called accident.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Tony, but you can't just jump to conclusions about anything, really, can you? You've got to get all the facts and then you know...
You know what we're doing is we're speculating.
Yes,
well, I am
indeed.
Anyway. I'm speculating that I don't think that this was... You know, and I think that's actually what the mainstream press are doing. They're finding it... Because they are all very suspicious about it, but they know that they're not really allowed to say, oh, looks like this might be an assassination. They're not even allowed to broach that topic. But so that's why I think it's been... in the news quite a bit. Anyway, I'll put that article. It's very interesting about the links to the intelligence services and exactly what this spyware did, because we haven't been told, not spyware, software, we haven't been told very much at all about the circumstances around this guy's trial, what his software does, the amounts of money involved, whether or not he's loyal to the United States or not. You know, that sort of thing they haven't talked about, which is all of the most important material if you want to decide whether this is really an accident or not. Another little story this week is a lady called Stella Maris from St Andrews University. Now, is that in Glasgow?
No, it's in St Andrews, which is in north of Scotland.
St Andrews University, poor old Stella Maris, she's a lecturer there, and she's just been told, in fact, she was one of the senior people running the university, that because she's shared some information, an email, which is calling for a ceasefire, that she's not... what do you make of that? She's not allowed to... She's been sacked from various of her jobs at the university. She's not been completely sacked, but from, for example, the court, they call it, that runs the university, she's no longer allowed to be part of that because she said that she thinks there should be a ceasefire.
Well, we know what's going on in academia in this country and elsewhere. People who stand up for Palestinian rights are being definitely cancelled. And that is, you know, we know the Zionist lobby is very vindictive, and they, you know, they are in a rampant mood, and they're basically chucking their weight around, aren't they? St Andrews, of course, is well known for being a spooky university. That's where people go who are, you know, the sort of NATO specialists, if you like, in intelligence and so on. That's what it's known for.
I remember when we were talking a bit about Warwick and Nick Land, that they've got this kind of very, very close link to the business world in Warwick. So the idea is that if you're going to get the latest innovations in business, that Warwick is a good place to go. What about in England and Wales? Are there other spooky universities?
Well, I think that Dave here will know that Aberystwyth is the British Army tends to put their people through Aberystwyth University. And that's what I've heard anyway.
Dave's looking a bit startled.
That's what I've heard. There was some guy who was British Army guy who was doing a degree, and he was famous for grassing up all the people who were drug users and getting them all arrested, which of course didn't in fact endear him to anybody, and rather made it obvious who he was.
Well, I mean, surely grasses are quite handy. You know, intelligence might want to recruit them.
Well, indeed, but I'm just saying. I mean, obviously, you know, Oxford and Cambridge. That's where where traditionally the intelligence services used to recruit. St. Andrews has got, you know, they have sort of experts on terrorism, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, okay. What about England? Cambridge is supposed to be spooky, isn't it?
Well, Oxford and Cambridge are where the MI5, MI6 used to recruit. They've got a wider pool of recruits now, but traditionally that's where they used to recruit from.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll share a link to the petition to help this lady, Stella Maris. But let's also hear Owen Jones has been speaking about this up on, I think it's on his YouTube channel.
Let's be clear. The real crime of those who have been demonised, hounded, victimised, silenced since this horror began has been to treat Palestinians as though their life is of equal worth. How dare these people, how dare they accuse others of not demonstrating equal care for human life? The rector rightly condemned the war crimes committed on the 7th of October, in which over 1,200, overwhelmingly Israeli, some foreign residents, citizens as well, were killed, including over 800 civilians and 36 children. By the time she wrote those words, around 14,000 Palestinians had been killed, around 6,000 children had been killed, with that overall death count likely, even back then, that was last November, it's now August, likely to be a significant underestimate because, for example, excluded those classified as missing, including thousands buried under rubble, those killed by indirect causes, which tend to be the primary cause of death overall in war, problems with underreporting deaths during an unprecedented all-out military assault, we could go on. The point, too, is that the massacre she rightly condemned of Israeli civilians happened on 7th of October. The massacre of Palestinians was happening at the time she was writing and is happening every single day in Gaza. She was describing an ongoing massacre, which, unlike 7th of October, was and is being directly facilitated, supported and armed by her government. We note the British government has still failed to end arms sales to Israel. A massacre that was and indeed is possible to stop by virtue of being ongoing. Indeed, since then, likely many tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed. And I'm sorry to say this, many more Palestinians to be killed yet to come. She rightly spoke of the ongoing massacre of Palestinians, which remains within our power to do something about, whilst rightly condemning the massacre of Israeli civilians, which took place on the 7th of October. Now, the statement from the Court of the University of St. Andrews discharged the rector, Stella Maris, from the role of president of court and as charity trustee. As I say, they state this independent investigation found the following. The rector was entitled to free speech, but had exercised poor judgment in the manner in which she wrote to all students to give her personal opinions on the conflict, specifically ignoring the possibility that her words from a position of leadership could encourage anti-Semitic behaviour by others. Reactions to the statement from the student body were divided. Some students, especially some Jewish students, were very distressed and angry and feared for their safety, while other students felt validated and heard. The rector's subsequent actions on social media fell below the standards required of a court member and inflamed tensions, it says.
Well, so it could inflame anti-Semitic sentiments in some people.
Well, this is the way these things work, isn't it? You've got some Jewish students in the university, as in Bristol, not necessarily the majority. They make a complaint saying that they don't feel safe. And then, of course, there's the whole question.
Jewish or Israeli or Zionist?
Well, no, they are pro-Zionist students, let's put it that way. They may be Israeli citizens, they may not.
They also may be Christian Zionists, mightn't they?
Well, not so much in this country. It's usually, I mean, this is what we know what happened in Bristol University, is that the Union of Jewish Students, which is funded by the Israeli Embassy, complained that they didn't feel safe having David Miller as a sociology professor, and the university sacked him. Even though there was an internal disciplinary showed there was no evidence of any anti-Semitism, and he lost his job, even though he won the employment tribunal. They are on the offensive. Look at what's happened in the US. Anybody who criticises the Israeli state can lose their job just like that if they're in a university. And of course, that's what they want. They want people terrified so that they daren't risk their careers. Some people are brave enough to speak out anyway, but a lot of people who've got kids in school and families, they don't want the bother. And that's why they do it. And then they scream about being cancelled. They're the cancellers. They can't take it, can they? They just can't take honest criticism.
Well, to a certain extent, no, you're right, they can't. But is that? Thinking of the context here, is the government is just saying that it doesn't want to implement this new law to give academics freedom of speech?
Well, in theory, in the past, if you were a tenured academic, you could not be disciplined for anything you said, as long as it was within, you know, within certain boundaries. But of course, what's happening now is this whole basically bogus anti-Semitism stuff is being wheeled out to silence people while we're watching an ongoing genocide, which anybody can pick up their phone and see what's going on. And the rest of the world doesn't regard this in this way at all. It's only in Britain, the United States and Europe where this is going on. In Germany, people have been prosecuted for saying from the river to the sea, because that's obviously anti-Semitic. And of course it isn't. It's just a political position, just like Crimea ought to be part of Ukraine as a political position. But it's an ongoing Hasbara offensive against everybody who is criticizing.
Well, what do you mean by Hasbara?
Hasbara is the technical term for Israeli propaganda operations.
Isn't there actually a document that was leaked which explains this all in black and white? It says, look, you know, we've got to target universities, we've got to target journalists and this
That's
sort
right,
of thing.
Yes.
And isn't it funny that people like Scott Ritter, Richard Medhurst are being targeted, funnily enough.
That's
it's
right.
Almost as if this is all straight out of the Hasbara manual. So I want to hear a bit more about this.
Well, I mean, they've been doing it for years, but they've now intensified it to a huge extent. I mean, this is, you know, the war takes place in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, but it also takes place in St. Andrews. It's going on over the whole world. The Israelis are determined to carry through their genocidal plans, and that includes silencing people who want to call it genocide. And what should be happening is academic institutions in this country should be saying, well, look, this is just fair criticism. You don't agree with what they're saying, but then they don't agree with you. Everybody in Britain thinks that Crimea should be part of the Ukraine. That's not what the people in Crimea think, but I could say they're all Russophobes and therefore they should lose their jobs. You hate the Russians, don't you? You've just got a thing about the Russians with all this stuff about Crimea should be part of Ukraine. And if you're going to carry on talking like that, you're going to lose your job. Now, can you see how absurd that would sound? But when they say it, it's, that's absolutely right, isn't it? But the rest of the world, in South Africa, for example, in Latin America, they can see the rank hypocrisy of this, where we're going to have sanctions on Russia, where they're not allowed to come to the Olympic Games, we're never going to talk to them ever again. But of course, Israeli athletes took part in the Olympic Games, who were part of the Israeli Defence Forces, which are actually involved in ongoing slaughter. Shouldn't they have been banned? If we're going to be consistent about banning people who go, maybe we should just let everybody compete, or we'll let nobody compete. Maybe we should just cancel the whole thing.
Yeah. So anyway, this Hasbara manual sounds interesting. I think I should just put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org, maybe even send a copy out as a PDF with the weekly newsletter, because I think it's important that people are aware that maybe some of our new laws are being either written or cancelled based on an Israeli. I mean, what is this? An intelligence manual? What is it? Is it just a government manual?
It's just
something that the Israel lobby have cooked up. Where's it from?
Well, the word Hasbara goes back quite a long way, and they've got plenty of people working on this. They've got various teams, and they keep changing the names of the teams that they've got doing it, but they regard trying to blacken the name of those who are criticising Israel and destroy their careers as very much part of the war that they're conducting. And they're being quite successful in it as well, because they, you know, lots of politicians, particularly in the United States, they do not dare to criticise the Israeli state, because they then looks what happened to Cori Black. I think it's Cori Black, I can't remember whether it's her second name. And she's just lost the Democratic nomination for her own seat to Congress, because the Zionist lobby piled money in to get rid of her because she was critical of Israel. So she's out. And that's what they do. And well, the money, of course, comes from the Israeli state, but ultimately from the US taxpayer, which subsidises the Israeli state, and then they use that money to control US politics.
Well, I'm afraid our money is going to, a lot of it's going to Ukraine, isn't it? We'll be hearing a bit about that after the break. But and we'll also be going back to look at the Israel lobby with a guest, hopefully, will be joining us around about 6 o'clock. But before that, in the background to all of this foreign policy madness is the domestic policy madness. Now, I don't know what you make of the honeymoon period of this new government, but straight first thing they've done, Martin, is take away many of these winter energy energy payments.
Well, they're means
for the elderly.
They're means testing them rather than, you know, people who are still on some kind of benefits will get them, but those others will not.
But they keep pointing out that many elderly people don't claim some of these means tested benefits, and so because they, you know, they just won't be getting the payments at all, even though they're entitled to them.
Yes, well, I mean, lots of elderly people don't claim stuff they're entitled to. In actual fact, that happens in the whole system all the time. Well, you can see what Rachel Reeves is trying to do. She's trying to manoeuvre a situation where she just says, oh, I'm afraid there isn't any money. She absolutely came out with it and said the credit card is maxed out before she was elected Chancellor, which is, you know, she's a trained economist. She's worked with the Bank of England. She knows that that's just a rubbish way to talk about the economy. But she did it because it keeps the editorial writers in the Daily Mail happy that she's on side. And so we've now got a pro-austerity Labour government. And, of course, she's paid the public sector, pay disputes have been settled. But nevertheless, she's not interested in any way in challenging the economic elites that run this country. And she's flagged that up. And she's, you know, she wants them to know that she is no threat to them.
So, just to make sure everyone is nose is rubbed in the dirt even further this over the next year, and particularly through this winter, rising energy price cap will be deeply worrying for families, says the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband. So let's have a listen to him earlier on today talking about the fact that, oh, sorry, everybody. Before we hear from him, Martin, what do you think the actual causes of the massive increase in energy prices are? So gas, electricity, fuel, diesel, petrol, that sort of thing.
The Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which we can't possibly discuss because, of course, the Germans have now said that they think it was the Ukrainians, and it was Zeluzhny, who is currently the ambassador, the Ukraine ambassador to Britain, who apparently signed off blowing up the pipeline. But, of course, this is actually a delusion because they haven't got the capacity to blow up the pipeline, and it was definitely the Americans. But can you see they're now trying to find another story which can explain what's going on. And of course they're saying Putin's invasion of the Ukraine. Putin and the Russians said you can carry on having gas. We're not cutting the gas supply off to you. You've just said you don't want this stuff and you've blown the pipeline up. And then and then people wonder, because that has a knock-on effect on all other energy prices across Europe, which is basically deindustrializing Europe to help the Americans. And it's not the Russians that have done it, it's the Americans who've done it.
It's funny, isn't it? Because we have to buy much of our energy from the United States.
That's indeed.
We would have been able to buy cheap from Russia.
That's right. Well, so, that's exactly what's going on. So, in other words, the tyranny of geography is that Russia's much closer to us than the United States. It makes a lot more sense for Germany in particular to get cheap energy from Russia and then create machine tools to sell to the Chinese, put their people to work and all the rest of it. But that undermines US hegemony.
So if you go to my Twitter feed, you'll find Sullivan, Burns and Baker sitting there. These are the three guys, I think, isn't it Jake Sullivan from the National Security Council in the States, chairing it. There's Burns from the CIA, and Baker, I think, is the guy from the Office of Net Assessments that says, look, it's going to cost this much, the cost-benefit analysis people, basically. And then those are the people that decided. And they were all at that Bilderberg conference back in, I think it was in Montreux, maybe, no, it was in the States, wasn't it, in 2021. Am I right? No, 2022, just before the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up. So there's the people that actually did it.
Well, according to Seymour Hersh, it was signed off by Biden. Obviously, he didn't make the decision, but he signed it off.
So, I mean, my other take on this energy thing, Martin, is that it's actually price fixing going on here for the benefit of shareholders. There's also a problem in that the nuclear that everyone is so-called committed to, you know, what with the Chinese, the French and the British government and the nuclear weapons industry, they need to have their nuclear power. This is megally expensive. And so they've had to come up with an energy system which makes the all of the cheaper energy as expensive as nuclear to make it look as if the nuclear is. So the whole thing is it's not an actual proper market. It's price fixing, upwards to make nuclear look credible.
Well, of course, in Germany, they've closed all their nuclear power stations down long before their natural life as part of their green agenda. But now they're having to burn more coal. The all energy prices are fixed. They were always fixed. You know, you make a pipeline to carry, gas or oil from A to B. There aren't three or four or five different pipelines that you can choose from any more than there are for the water supply. And, of course, ultimately, a lot of this stuff is decided by, geopolitical decisions about who we're going to be friends with and who we're going to buy from and who we're not going to buy from. And, of course, we cut off people we don't like we're not supposed to buy anything from the Russians, although, in actual fact, indirectly, we still are buying stuff from the Russians because they sell it on to the Turks, and then the Turks sell it on to us as energy,
Martin,
from Azerbaijan.
Isn't this partly the fault of these derivative markets? Because they're kind of betting on design. I mean, for example, right now, out in the Red Sea, there's a Greek oil tanker which is just smoking that the crew had to be rescued from. It's now drifting that the Yemenis have hit. And so obviously insurance rates are going up. People are starting to think, well, maybe we just can't take our oil through the Red Sea anymore. And this was, in a way, is kind of inevitable. As inevitable as night follows day. As this genocide starts to unroll, then this is one of the things which the indigenous people of the Middle East are going to do. They're going to say, well, you people that just arrived here in 1948, we've had enough of you, and any of your tankers that come through the Red Sea, we're going to sink them, or we're going to knock them out, and we're going to make it impossible for you to use this part of the world.
Well, if you think about the original oil price shock in 1973, it was because the Arab states decided that because the US had supported the Israeli war effort in 1973, they were going to punish the West by forming a cartel, the OPEC cartel, and driving the price of oil up. And of course, that's what you do. There isn't a free market where, you can buy, there are hundreds of people selling apples, and you can walk around the market and decide which apples you want. No. Saudi Arabia, it used to be at that stage the biggest producer, and if they decide to reduce production, that increases the price and massively affects the global economy. But it's not a kind of economic decision. It was a decision made on the back of the 1973 war and the outcome of the war. So in other words, the price of energy is actually set by warfare.
Right, and also, it seems to me, the price of energy in this country is actually set by corporate elites, and the people who are there to implement this are people like Ed Miliband.
Well, Ed Miliband has ended up being in charge of the energy sector.
Oh, just by accident. Yeah.
Well, not by accident.
Nothing to do with the fact that he was a very nice, pliable politician before, even though the people didn't want to vote for him. But let's bring him back in and put him back in charge of energy. I bet this is King Charles, one of the people that rather loves Ed Miliband.
Well,
he's one of these climate. We've got to frame everything around net zero. This is exactly King Charles's attitude.
Ed Miliband won election to the parliament this time in his constituency. I don't know where it is,
he won election. What party would try and put into power someone who's already lost them an election?
No, you can...
you can do it, but why? Well, you're not after votes, are you? You're not after votes. What are you after?
Listen, don't forget, he stood against his brother, who wanted to, who was in favour of the war in Iraq. So in actual fact, of all the people in the cabinet, he's got some credibility, Tony.
He lost the election.
Yes, he lost the election. So did Jeremy Corbyn twice.
Should he?
So if you lose an election, you can't be an MP.
No, well, not exactly.
No.
Because Corbyn did really well. He nearly
won. That's right.
Ed Miliband didn't. And he opened up the way for somebody like Corbyn to come along.
Yes. And now he's still been elected as a constituency MP in his constituency. You've never stood for election in any constituency, anywhere.
Martin, you're starting to personalise this.
I'm starting to personalise this. You're talking about Ed Miliband.
This is infantile.
No, you're talking about Ed Miliband and why he shouldn't be energy secretary. Yes. Let's talk about his energy policy. Not this whole silliness about he can't be the energy secretary. He didn't win the election, and well, maybe he should just go off and do something
else. Is this
he's
is,
a politician.
This is this
he's
is,
energy secretary. Let's somebody, talk about his policy.
Somebody who's voted out in a general election, who tries to lead the country into a Labour government. The idea of bringing this is exactly what the Tories did with Cameron, isn't it? Let's bring back somebody who's a failure and put them in
Cameron
charge.
Cameron wasn't a this member of Parliament.
Cameron was
no,
before.
When he was brought back, he had to be made a Lord. So it was unusual and out of the ordinary.
It's all extremely
Miliband
unusual.
Miliband is a member of Parliament. He's been a member of a cabinet and shadow cabinets for years. You seem to have something against him. I'm not particularly in favour of him. He's very centrist from my point of view. But the idea that because he didn't win an election, he can't be an MP and he can't be the energy secretary is just trivial.
He's mates with the COP people. He's mates with the zero carbon people.
Yes, he's very much a climate change person.
He's
going to
do what the World Economic Forum want.
Yes, he probably is, and so most of the others. Name me one of them that isn't.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe there are one or two.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah,
must
well,
go on. Let's hear the
I'm
name.
Not sure. But anyway, he is quite obviously being brought in to do this job. So let's have a listen to what his little weaselly excuse as to why. Oh, I'm very sorry, everybody. Oh, we're just going to have to jack your energy prices up again. So in other words, he's much more interested, rather like Keir Starmer, in the World Economic Forum, economic slavery, than he is in the voters.
So let's get more now on the rise in the energy price cap that's been announced by the regulator Ofgem this morning. Prices up by around 10%. In the last few minutes, we've managed to speak to the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband. Here's what he had to say. Disappointed by that?
I know this will be really worrying news for lots of families who will face even greater struggles this winter. And it's a direct result of our country's exposure to international gas markets that are controlled by dictators. And that is a legacy left to us by the last government. That's why this government has a plan to do something about it. Our mission for clean, homegrown power that we control in this country. And it's why we've hit the ground running in just 7 weeks, consenting new solar power, overturning the ban on onshore wind, precisely to give our country the energy security we don't have at the moment. And this government will also do everything it can to protect bill payers, reforming the regulator so it's a strong champion of consumers, making standing charges fairer, and increasing funding for energy efficiency so people can cut bills. But this is obviously really worrying news for lots of families in our country.
You can't keep blaming your inheritance, though, can you? It comes as you're scrapping the winter fuel allowance. 10 million pensioners in England and Wales are due to lose that money, and now they'll see that they'll have to pay increased energy costs as well. I mean, part of that is your decision. And how concerned are you about hardship this winter?
Well, look, the truth is that the mess that was left to us in the public finances is what necessitated that decision around winter fuel payments and us focusing it on those who need it the very most. That's why this government is also driving throughout the coming months to get the people, the 880,000 pensioners who are entitled to pension credit and not getting it, to try and get them to take it up, to make them aware of this so they can get the winter fuel payment as well. So it was a difficult decision that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, made, but it was also a direct result of the legacy left to us by the last government.
People will see, though, that there's enough money for train drivers, there's enough money for junior doctors, there's not enough money for certain other people in society. I mean, what do you say to people that won't be able to keep their heating on this winter?
Well, look, I am incredibly sympathetic to all of the people who are going to be struggling this winter. I'm not just sympathetic, we're going to act. We will be doing everything we can, working with the regulator, working with the suppliers to remind them of their responsibilities to the most vulnerable in our society. And this government will leave no stone unturned in the months ahead to do everything we can to protect bill payers. We don't just have a long-term plan for our country. We will take all the action we can to protect bill payers.
So there he is. What a pander. Look, you know, Horsey could nationalise, for example, couldn't he? That would rather help things. Are you saying we're doing everything we can? We're doing everything we can. Also, oh, it's very good. Just go onto a website and see if you can choose another energy provider. This is jumping through hoops that the energy industry themselves want people to do. And so everyone's going to have to just put up with this. There's no government pushback, it seems, at all. Not only that, he's stopping all these new oil concessions. And so energy bills are only going upwards.
Well, it wasn't in the Labour manifesto to renationalise the oil industry, the gas industry, or the electricity.
So is he doing everything he can?
No, he could probably do a lot more. And Rachel Reeves is one who makes the decisions about. He's just the energy secretary. She's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He is a part of a cabinet which is a pro-austerity Labour cabinet. We know what we're getting. We know we're getting a pig in a poke here. We know what Starmer's position is.
And is the gas market being controlled by dictators?
It's not being controlled by dictators. Putin, as I said earlier, and the Russians said, you can carry on having your gas. We will sell it to you. And we decided not to buy it in order to bring the dictator down. Except it hasn't brought him down.
Surely the actual aim was exactly what Miliband's spelling out there, is to jack up energy prices to impoverish people.
They are doing what big capital wants them to do. You are right. But on the other hand, if you wanted to have a revolutionary policy, Tony, you'd have to vote for somebody else, not for Starmer's Labour.
I don't think revolutions come through votes, do they?
Well, in that case, if you want to nationalise, it can happen. It did happen in Russia in 1917. Everything was nationalised. Is that what Starmer and Miliband stand for? No, it isn't. Are you surprised? I'm not.
I mean, the only kind of very active, like, revolutionary government around these days seems to be the Iranians. They had a revolution, didn't they, in 1979?
Yes, and in 1954, the British overthrew the democratically elected government there because they nationalised British petroleum. And we overthrew them and put in our dictator, the Shah of Iran. And, of course, he was ultimately overthrown and they renationalised their oil industry. But a lot of people died in the process. It was a bloody process. And, of course, the revolution isn't really over. The fighting continues in the Middle East. Ed Miliband is a low-level, mid-level bureaucrat in a Labour administration. What do you expect him to do? He's going to do exactly what he just said. He's not going to change the world. He's not going to renationalise the oil industry, the gas industry. And in any case, there's certain things that you want. Once they're gone, they're gone. The steel industry, for example, in this country is gone. It ain't coming back anytime at all.
We've still got steel in Port Talbot, haven't we?
At the moment. How long do you think that's going to last with the energy prices going through the roof?
Well, maybe
and
not.
Of course, the consequence of all of this is ultimately going to be a recession, which will turn into a depression. And this Labour government is not going to preside over steady economic growth.
Well, it might be that
where they can redistribute.
It might be that
the
establishment,
work like that.
The establishment, the City of London, and the Anglo-Zionist Empire is just going to crash the economy on this government, like they did on Gordon Brown in the last Labour government.
It's not the economy may crash either because it's been deliberately crashed or it may just crash anyway. If we've been waiting for
this is deliberate, isn't it? The idea of jacking up energy prices, it just means people have got less spending power, and the economy starts to crash. I mean, it's obvious. What's happening is all the infrastructure, which is now controlled by private interests, they're saying, well, this is the only way we can make money now. They need their gas, they need their electricity, they need their cars, they need their water. Let's just jack up the price of all of this. In fact, they're doing exactly the same with water, aren't they?
Well, they do. This is exactly what's the problem with this model of capitalism that we've been living under for the last 40
years. Financialisation. Finance capitalism.
Yeah, but what will ultimately happen is the British economy will go down the drain. Meanwhile, our enemies, the Russians, their economy will carry on booming and they will win the war with their nationalised arms industry, which we haven't got. We are going to have a big crisis in Western Europe because of the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which nobody can talk about. Ed Miliband, as Energy Secretary, can't mention it, nor can Rachel Reeves, as Chancellor of the Exchequer. But it is the single factor which has most caused the problems that we're going to face now. And, of course, that's the whole of industry and the whole of Europe is going to be decimated.
Well, I think it's
Labour government in this country...
I think, actually, it's more of an excuse, Nord Stream pipeline. The fact is they wanted these energy prices to go through the roof anyway. This is very convenient for them because most of the profits are going back to the United States shareholders.
That's right. And Ed Miliband, rather than stopping them, is just going along with the flow. You are right. He's going along with the flow. Maybe he should be calling us to the barricades, Tony. What do you think?
Well,
War with the United States of America.
He's the guy, okay, he's the guy who they know is just kind of come out with the claptrap and see people go descending into poverty, even though he says, oh, we're doing everything we can. He's doing absolutely very, very little, put it like that. Anyway, the science behind all this is interesting. Dr. Richard Lindzen is a US scientist, the climate scientist's keynote speech, they say. Keynote science, consensus and the politics of climate change. There's a recent meeting in Brussels. We've had him on before. But this is what he's got to say about some of the science around climate change.
This is not a unique issue. There have been quite a few issues, some very serious, where science was used to crush opposition and the science was baseless. But a consensus was claimed. In the U.S., one issue that I've studied a bit was the exploitation of eugenics as being defined by essentially human heredity, with the discovery of the Mendel's genetic theory. One began to think of certain human qualities like simple-mindedness as being a single gene recessive property. And so the engineering aspect was you could control the intelligence of your community by selective breeding and by avoiding inferior people. This was eugenics, which everyone agreed with, the good and the powerful in the 1920s. In America, that was used to introduce immigration restriction in 1924. It's interesting that eugenics actually is one of those things for which you have a mathematical proof that it can't work. It's known as the Hardy-Weinberg theorem. I won't go through that at this point. It didn't matter. It satisfied the needs of the politicians, and it went through. A worse example of that, of course, was the leading American exponent of eugenics and immigration policy was a scientist called Laughlin, and he was awarded in the 1930s an honorary degree from Heidelberg. And Hitler, of course, appealed to eugenics for his policies, and again insisted that there was scientific consensus. In some ways, the worst example I know of was Lysenkoism, which was a rejection of the existence of a gene, and which Stalin liked because it said that they could impose changes in their agriculture that would make it more productive just by grafting and doing things like that. And Stalin insisted that all biological scientists in the Soviet Union agree with this. He thus destroyed biology in the Soviet Union. And indeed, thousands of scientists objected and were sent to the Gulag, and several were killed. So there are ways to impose nonsense on people. And we've seen this before. The exploitation of climate fits this pattern remarkably well. And one of the things about that is in such issues, in fact, the science is irrelevant. And that's a kind of dangerous because it's a distraction. It led many of us, including myself, to look at the numerous impossibilities and errors in the theory. The statement that you feel the science has been well developed means you haven't looked at it. That's all it means.
So that's Richard Lindzen. I'll put a link to the full version of that up on our show page with several other speakers at that conference in Brussels recently on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Eugenics is very well documented. Do you think he's right, Martin, to compare this to some of this climate science?
Well, I think that it's a debate that needs to be had, does it not?
But it's not being had, is it really, at all?
Well, to some extent it is. We're having it now. Here we are.
This is why we're here, because no one else is talking about this. Well, at least certainly very few people in the... There's nothing in the mainstream, and very few people in the alternative press.
People like Trump are pretty clear that they don't really believe in climate change. And people are voting for him because they think that he's saying
asking you specifically about this look at eugenics and this whole idea of scientism, the idea that you can create a whole kind of so-called consensus, is what he's saying there, that a completely fake consensus.
Well, science...
I suppose the same's true in economics, isn't it?
The same's true in anything, because you can, in actual fact, people pushing an agenda will push their agenda if they think they can get away with it.
It's almost like the mafia. You know, anyone that speaks up who's a scientist, who's actually knows what they're talking about, and who's got some serious questions that might undermine your theory, well, bye-bye. They're going to be out the window.
I mean, as you will know, Tony, in science itself, there's constant rows and arguments about what is actually right and what's wrong. And, of course, if it's done properly, there is a debate that takes place between qualified scientists, and they disagree. There is, when you say there's a consensus, there's usually some people who don't agree with that consensus. That's true in every scientific field.
So overall, I mean, this thing is this. There's a lot. We're banking everything on this whole zero carbon thing, aren't we?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, they're talking about it, but nothing's going to happen because we're going to have
But it is happening. Look, everything's... The whole energy sector is changing as a result of this science, so-called science.
Yes, I know. Speaking as an economist, I would say that this is a lot of talk. In actual fact, we are as dependent on these fossil fuels as we ever were, especially as we're going to war. And tanks do not run on windmills. They need oil and gas. The Challenger tanks, which have just been destroyed in the Kursk battlefield, they are absolute gas guzzlers. And that's another one of the problems that the Germans
have. We'll be hearing later. Yeah. Apparently they've run out of fuel.
Well, indeed. So in other words, we're going to have to get more fuel to those tanks if we're going to defeat the dictators, and therefore zero carbon will just have to wait.
But isn't it the case that if there is a war in the Middle East, which it seems has been being planned for quite a long time, then those tankers won't be getting through. So maybe a lot of this policy is around just coping when they know that the oil tankers are going to get blown up with torpedoes.
What will happen, I was going to say a bit earlier, was we've been waiting for the full response from Hezbollah and Iran to the assassinations of their respective leaders, and nothing much has happened. But, of course, what did happen was there was an immediate sell-off in the stock markets, because, of course, if they do have a major war in the Middle East, the oil price, the gas price, energy prices are going to go through the roof, stock markets are going to collapse, and everybody's going to be put out of work. And we won't be worrying about zero carbon anything. We'll be worrying about feeding ourselves. And that's what wars are like. So you've got all these fantasies about, let's all get together and do something about climate change, but first we've got to defeat China and defeat Russia. And that will require a bit of oil and gas if we're going to defeat them, except we're
now,
not
who's going to
defeat
fight
them.
These wars?
Well, it looks at the moment like the Ukrainians and the Palestinians.
So no, the British Army not involved.
The British Army are inside the Kursk salient as we speak. I'm sure they
have.
You
got any evidence for that?
Oh, listen, the Russians have been putting... they're pretty clear it was the British who were behind the whole operation. And, of course, the Storm Shadow missiles that we keep talking about, the Ukrainians don't know how to fire them. So somebody British is firing them. And, of course, when they are knocked out by the Russians, there will be British people being killed there. That has already been going on for the last 3 or 4 years. There's loads of French mercenaries who are actually French soldiers who've been killed in the Ukraine. The Russians are very well aware that they're already fighting NATO military personnel. And they've said to them, you can come if you like, but we will kill you. And that's what they've been doing.
So, mentioning the Storm Shadow missiles, these have been in the news this week. Quite a discussion about whether or not they should be being used by the Ukrainians in this Kursk salient, in other words, a part of Russia. So the British are a little bit nervous about this. They say, yes, it's okay for you to use our missiles to attack Crimea, because legally, we argue, that's still part of Ukraine. But you can't use them to hit Russia.
Well, of course, as you know, Starmer went to the NATO conference in Washington and said he was happy for them to be used to hit Russia. And then the Minister of Defence here said, no, because the Russians have already said, if you start doing that, we're going to fire back. And we might fire back at Britain. Yeah, if you're going to fire at one of our bases in our country, we're going to fire at one of your bases in your country. So everybody at Plymouth or on Salisbury Plain, get your tin hats on, because we're going to fire back. You kill our soldiers, we're going to kill your soldiers. That's exactly where we're at with all of this. And of course, the Labour government talking about over a 10-year period, we're going to get to net zero. it's just fantasy world because we're actually on the brink of World War III. And when the missiles arrive, people will realise.
Martin, I find it difficult sometimes with you because you're always saying we're on the brink of some sort of big disaster, whether it's a financial crash or a world war.
And then it never happens.
Well, so far it hasn't. But why do you think this time? I'm giving you, you know, a little bit of credibility and wriggle room here. Why do you think this time it really is going to happen?
Because the patience of the Russians with the attitude of the West is running out. Putin is under pressure from his own people when they know that British special forces are involved in, for example, in the Crocus massacre. They know. They know they were involved in it. And they're saying, well, why can't we hit back? And Putin is under pressure from his own people. Why can't we hit back?
Well, let's have
a
listen.
British are being really annoying. Why don't we bloody
know?
Let's
have a listen to see what Scott Richards got to say about that.
NATO invaded Russia. And that includes the United States. One of the things that have come out of this is that, and the Russians, have killed and captured a large number of Ukrainians, and they've captured a large number of amount of equipment, and they've captured the, plans. And so through interrogation, evaluation of captured material, the Russian military has concluded that the force that came in was organized unlike any Ukrainian force Russia has ever encountered in the past. This force was organized as to be the equivalent of the most advanced NATO fighting force with total informational awareness, the full integration of artificial intelligence, satellite connectivity, real-time interactions so that as the troops advance, they're getting real-time updates on where the Russians are and where the Russians aren't. Artificial intelligence helped predict outcomes, design the best way forward. This allowed the Ukrainians to advance rapidly because normally you're probing the way. This way, with this new connectivity, they're able to find the gap, shoot the gap, exploit the gap. Communications are outstanding, which also leads to more effective fire support. So these Ukrainians were more lethal, more capable. This was a very, very good Ukrainian force that went into the Kursk area.
I mean, effectively, he's saying that these may be mostly Ukrainian fighters, but it's NATO equipment and NATO tech behind this attack on Russia.
There's also NATO personnel. I think the Russians have been pretty clear about that.
So what he's also saying there, really, is that the Russians perceive this as an attack by NATO.
They do. And at a certain point, the Russian population, they've just had an election which Putin won overwhelmingly, are saying, it's about time we gave them a taste of their own medicine, isn't it?
Yeah, but Putin doesn't have to listen to this. He's his
own
person.
No, he doesn't. No, because he's got such a strong position politically, he can face down those people and say, well, you just leave this to me.
In a way, by not doing anything, by not retaliating, his position is strengthened, isn't it? Because there are more and more, he gets more and more sympathy and from both sides, the hawks and otherwise.
Yeah, well, also, of course, he's talking to other world leaders. From South Africa, from China, from India, and he's trying to convince them. Look, we're bending over backwards to try and de-escalate this.
What do you make of Modi's visit from India to both Russia and now to Ukraine?
Well, I mean, I think this is international politics at the highest level, isn't it? Modi was told not to go to Russia, just as Imran Khan was in Russia when the special
by whom. By the Americans.
The Americans told Modi not to go. I mean, nobody's supposed to be talking to the Russians. Nobody's supposed to be dealing with them. The whole world has got to stop this dictator. But, of course, the rest of the world outside Western Europe is not doing that at all. They are still talking to the Americans. They're still talking to us. But they're still talking to the Russians because they don't see there's any reason why they shouldn't. And that is very, very annoying to the Ed Miliband's, Keir Starmer's, Joe Biden's, Donald Trump's of this world, but the rest of the world doesn't see it like we see it. They really don't.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of using long-range weapons is designed to inflame the war, basically, British and I think it's the United States and is it French and Italian?
No, the Germans stuff as well.
I don't think the Germans have said no, you can't use our stuff.
No, they've got their missile. What's going on is they're rowing amongst themselves about whether they dare.
But anyway, the Americans are leading
Burrell, who's the EU foreign affairs person, is saying he's in favour of these missiles being used to strike
long-range strikes in Russia. In fact.
Yeah, but
exactly
what the Russians have said, as soon as the British started saying this, they called the British ambassador in and said, if you do that, we are going to fire back. Now, you think twice before you do this. And of course, the Russian population are getting fed up with this. Terrorist attacks inside Russia, the assassination of Dugin's daughter, the Crocus attack, the various things have been going on. There was drone attacks in Moscow the last week. And they're saying, why can they do that to us and we can't do it back to them? Why don't we do it back to them? Because we can do it back to them. Well, they know we can do it back to them. So if they're going to fire long-range missiles at us, let's fire our long-range missiles at them, and that means Bristol, if necessary. What about the the training place we have up the top here in Bristol, where people go to, you know, do reserve training?
The Ukrainians
kill a few people there.
That the their own troops aren't well trained enough. A battalion commander. When Ukraine's 47th Brigade has said this week, some people don't want to shoot. They see the enemy in the firing position in the trenches, but they don't open fire. That's why our men are dying. When they don't use the weapons, then they're ineffective. So it sounds to me as if you've got people that either don't want to or just can't use the weapons in the Ukrainian.
Well, a lot of the
conscripts, are they?
A lot of the really dedicated, hardcore neo-Nazi fighters have all been killed. The Russians have been mashing them to pieces. They've lost over 500,000 dead, never mind wounded. And meanwhile, fools like Keir Starmer are cheering it all on and saying, we've got to double down here. You know, it's just insane. We should be looking for a way out. We're not looking for a way out. Apparently, we're looking for a way to escalate. But I think that Rachel Reeves is going to find it very hard to balance the books when the balloon goes up.
So the Ukraine is also saying it's been using US-made GBU-39 bombs inside Russia's Kursk Oblast. The US is expected to announce a new arms package for Ukraine on Friday. The Ukrainian Air Force said on Thursday its forces had used US-made GBU-39 small-diameter bomb in a strike on a Russian platoon. The GBU-39 is a 250-pound bomb, typically fired from an aircraft. The US has also provided the Ukraine with a land-based version that can be fired by the HIMARS rocket systems, known as the ground-launched small-diameter bomb. So the Americans' stuff is definitely being used against Russia in Kursk.
Well, that's right. And, of course, public opinion in Russia. What would public opinion in Britain be if the Russians had taken over Kent and said, we're taking over Kent.
It's not a very good example, is it? Say, maybe Cornwall, somewhere which is a little bit more alien to London.
Well, I mean, the point is, the British population were demanding we want these people kicked out. That's what the Russian population is saying. Get these people out of our country. Do what you've got to do.
And will they?
They will. Of course they will. This is just a last throw of the dice. As Scott Ritter has been following this very closely all the way, you know, ex-US Marine Corps colonel and all the rest of it. This is too clever by half, yeah? They've extended the front. They're already being ground down by the fact that they're outnumbered. They're completely outgunned. They've got no air cover compared to the Russians. And to extend the front, and also to extend it politically into Russia, it's daring in one way. It's like, you know, gosh, that's a daring sort of a thing to do. But it's also the last gasp. Soon enough, possibly before the end of the year, the Ukrainian army is simply going to collapse. They won't be able to fight anymore. They'll either surrender or run away, and then the Russians will advance
me that the Russians are taking a very, very, you know, it, whatever happens, we're not fighting back. We're not firing back. We're just not going to do it because we know you want us to. It's a little bit like over in Gaza. But anyway, look, we're going to be speaking to our guest in a second or in a few minutes. But before that, finally, let's have a listen to the second and final clip from Scott Ritter, where he talks here about the supply lines, whether or not the supply lines into Kursk from Ukraine are being broken by the Russians.
Let's go back to Kursk. Have the Russians cut off supply lines from Ukraine to Kursk, or can these invaders still get fuel, ammunition, food, medical supplies, whatever they need?
My understanding is that the Russians have put considerable amount of effort into seeking to denigrate and eliminate and suppress and cut Ukraine's logistical bases and lines of communication connecting them to the four deployed units. According to the Russian officers who are doing the fighting, the Ukrainians are lacking their mobility because they've run out of gas. In many cases, they're compelled to abandon their equipment and move into tree lines and into housing areas and dig in, awaiting some sort of reinforcement. But as the Ukrainians bring troops, divert them from the front, because it's now the Ukrainians that are diverting troops from a front line that can't afford to have troops diverted, right. They're assembling and they're getting bombed. The Russians have, put in there what they call intelligence surveillance reconnaissance assets that are surveilling the Sumy area. And anytime new forces come in, they're being hit immediately by these glide bombs. And as they seek to move into the Kursk area, they're being interdicted by artillery, by multiple rocket launchers, a lot of Iskander missiles, ballistic missiles, aircraft, helicopters. And so, on occasion, a pickup truck may get through with some food and ammunition and maybe a couple 5-gallon jerry cans of fuel, but not the significant, sustainable logistic supply that needs to occur. Russia has effectively cut that off.
Or is Zelensky crazy enough to have this invasion force attack Russian nuclear facilities?
That appears to be one of the principal goals and objectives of this, is to have these Ukrainians seize the Kursk nuclear power plant, and then Zelensky would seek a trade, returning Kursk to the Russians in exchange for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant that is currently occupied by the Russians and is part of the new territory of Zaporizhia, which Russia has, annexed following referendum in September 2022. So that was the goal. That was the objective. But from everything the Russians have told me, the Ukrainians didn't even get close. So the nuclear power plant is very well defended, and even its outer rings of defense weren't even approached. The Ukrainians didn't even get that close. But that appears to be, according to the interrogation of Russian prisoners of war, or Ukrainian prisoners of war, and the documents seized by the Russians, that appears to be one of the main goals and objectives of this Kursk operation, was the capture of the Kursk nuclear power plant.
So he's saying that run out of fuel. We're not hearing that on the news over here. It doesn't sound like it's going to be that easy for them to extricate themselves from Kursk. But and I mean, if they haven't got any fuel, it's not going to be easy for them to survive in there, is it?
No. So in other words, this is a kind of an attack which is for PR reasons. But from a military point of view, it's doomed to failure. They can't even retreat. Because as they retreat, they're just going to be massacred.
And you were saying last week there are some people that said that the Russians deliberately allowed them to do this, knowing that it was going to be strategically a disaster.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because they demined the area. Yeah. Why would you demine the area? Yeah.
The Russians, you mean?
Yeah, the Russians demined the area, and that then led the British special forces and other people who would think, oh, look, they've opened up a gap there. We could go through that gap. But it may be, and I'm not saying it is or it isn't, because the historians will have to find out about that, because the Russians don't say if it was a trap, they're not going to say anything about it.
They will keep shtum, inscrutably. What about this nuclear plant?
Well, obviously, it makes sense from a sort of PR point of view, if they could have seized the Kursk nuclear plant or even just blown it up and created a chaos.
Well, that would be radiation then pouring
out. Yes, I know,
it.
But they didn't get there. As Warren Thornton was pointing out last week, they're 20, 30 kilometres short. They're now, there's no way they're going to get there. It's just turned into another extension of the front.
This is right. I mean, the Russians are really kind of into the shadow play here, aren't they?
Well, everybody is playing games and trying to spin what they're doing, and then on the ground there's actually all the killing going on, which is pretty relentless. And, this is an appalling war that should never have been fought. A deal should have been done in April 2022, when Boris Johnson turned up and said, no, we're going to fight on until Putin falls. Putin isn't going to fall, and the war is still going on. Ultimately, the Ukrainian army is going to collapse, the Russians are going to get everything they want here, and the West is going to have a nervous breakdown.
Well, yes, lots of pointless killing also going on down on the Gaza Strip still in Palestine. And I'm joined on the line now by Tom Suarez. Tom, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great, Tom. Can you first maybe just tell us whereabouts you are? And I did see a fascinating talk by you about what's going on, you think, now in Gaza. So tell us a bit about your background.
I'm a violinist, but I have long been a historian of the Palestinian issue and an activist in the Palestinian issue. The culmination of what I've done is in a recent book titled Palestine Hijacked, which to me is like a handbook of activism, a handbook of how do we end this horror. And I had lived in the West Bank, living in Bethlehem, teaching in East Jerusalem, teaching music. And in 2014, at the end of 2014, I was asked to move from Bethlehem to Gaza to take over the violin students at that branch. And the conservatory and I, predictably, spent the next year trying to get me past the Israeli siege without success. So here I am in London.
So it was they just simply wouldn't. You had to have a visa to get in there or something, did you? Or what? How do you mean?
Well, it is a blockade unless you have some diplomatic excuse which the Israelis find acceptable. And the conservatory did have consulates of European countries that were trying to help, but nothing satisfied the Israelis. So I taught my students there from Bethlehem by Skype whenever the electricity and the internet in Gaza City were working. And this was really an exercise to let the students there feel that they had not been forgotten. But obviously this in the long term is not adequate.
Okay, so what years are we talking about here? And can you just describe what life was like there for those that have never visited the West Bank?
Life in the West Bank, well, it's a picnic next to Gaza. But everything is if Israel allows it, the entire economic system, travel, as you know, and travel, we're speaking within the West Bank, travel is always restricted, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, that with Oslo, the Palestinian territories were divvied up into these Bantustans, and Israel gave everybody, every non-Jew in these territories, ID cards, assigning them either to the West Bank, to East Jerusalem, which legally is one territory, but Israel divided it up, or an ID card in Gaza. And this was always sort of a heaven, purgatory, and hell. The heaven being East Jerusalem, which was where people wanted to be. And again, this is legally, even according to the so-called 67 borders, which is a whole nother story, but even according to that, East Jerusalem is not in Israel. End of story. Then the purgatory was the West Bank, and the hell was always Gaza. You could be evicted from, ethnically cleansed from East Jerusalem to the West Bank, or from the West Bank to Gaza, but you could never go the other way around.
Wow, amazing. And what about your actual work as a music teacher? Was that reasonably trouble-free? Were you able to get on with the job and teach the young people the violin?
We all did what we could. Now, the first problem is that Israel only allows you a 90-day visa. If you get in, you have a 90-day visa, which means that all the international teachers have to leave before the 90 days are up and then try to get back in. So you can never actually feel that you live there because you never, every 90 days, you never know whether you're going to get back in or not. Then it did happen many times where we make all these plans, the students learn their pieces, we're going to have a concert. At the last second, the intervention in our affairs scuttles the whole thing. This happened time and time again. You can never make any plans. And simply getting material into the West Bank is always an issue, more of an issue with Gaza. But it was already an issue in the West Bank. Simply stated, you felt like you had lead boots on, that every time you tried to do something, you always knew that at the end of the day, it was as long as Israel didn't scupper it.
I mean, we always hear from people like the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and his supporters here in Britain, in the United States and elsewhere, that unless we deal with Hamas, we destroy Hamas, then their attitude and their terrorism is going to grow like a cancer and spread throughout the world. What about this sort of mass surveillance and almost like kind of prison world that the Israelis are imposing?
That is certainly what they've turned the Palestinian territories into. But as far as Hamas goes, Hamas is not simply a political party that won the election in 2006. And to be clear, they won the election as the representative of the entire Palestinian population there, not just Gaza, but we, the so-called West, we didn't like it, so we fought them, and they were ended up being corralled in Gaza. Now, I have to be careful what I say, because as people like Mick Napier and Tony Greenstein and other people know full well, there is no freedom of speech about this issue in the UK. So I need to be a bit discreet, but let's just say that Hamas is more than simply this political party. It is the resistance. In 2006, we gave the Palestinians a choice. You can either have Fatah, which had become synonymous with corruption and was in the pockets of the Israeli government, or you can have Hamas, which, well, they're a bit bonkers in ways, but the fact is that they, at the time, they had proven themselves to be helpful to common Palestinians, and they were an opposition to Israel. So whatever you think of them, for many Palestinians, this was a no-brainer if you give us this choice. Now, this is surely not the option that most Palestinians would have wanted, but it has to do with what we offered them, because the real Palestinian leaders had either been assassinated or imprisoned by Israel. But the bottom line is that let's say hypothetically you can destroy Hamas. For argument's sake, let's say you can do that. But you cannot destroy the opposition to the shackles on which we have imprisoned the Palestinians. You can't get rid of that. So whether you destroy Hamas or not is irrelevant.
Yeah, I just wondered. I mean, it looks to me as if the Israelis are accusing Hamas of something that they're guilty of, which is actually imposing a very dangerous, even a diabolical system of surveillance. I mean, okay, so they're saying that the Hamas are fanatics, that they want to end the state of Israel. I mean, some people have even been saying, Tom, that the most likely person to bring about an end to Israel is the Prime Minister Netanyahu himself.
The business about bringing an end to Israel is very interesting, because we are allowed a spectrum of debate about this issue. Now, the spectrum of debate which we have been allowed does not include obvious truths. Now, what is Israel? Israel is the state that, by its own definition, must maintain the entire indigenous population, either under apartheid within the territory it controls, or in internment camps, so-called refugee camps, which are in truth internment camps externally, generation after generation. The fact is that if the actual people of the land simply went home and were equals, the Israeli state would cease to exist. Now, what kind of a state is this that it cannot exist except by maintaining this system of internment camps for millions of people and apartheid. What kind of a state is this? So if this horror is ever going to end, yes. Yes, we need to examine the Israeli state itself, and the inevitable conclusion will be that the state must end. And in its place, a new state, which is the state of everybody, equal under the law. And sure, let's say all the settlers stay, the latest settlers fresh off the plane from wherever they're coming from, fine, in the outpost, fine, everybody stays. But the actual native people of the land return home as equals. In this construct, which we in the so-called enlightened West claim to hold dear, this whole idea of equality, well, if you have this, then there is no Israeli state. There's no way to square that.
Yeah, certainly would be a bit difficult. But, I mean, I rather like the idea that your book talks about solutions, because we hear a lot about the horrors of this. In fact, most of the news reporting is, you know, a little zoom on a massacre, a horrific event here and there. And so, you know, the mass media tends not to look at the bigger picture, how we got here, how we get out of this. But the Israel lobby is very powerful, isn't it? And I know here in the UK, we've just been talking about it earlier on in the show, the power of particularly of the Israel lobby to get its way in British politics, to get its way in US politics. What do you make of the lobby?
I have no patience with this business about the Israeli lobby. Now, the Palestinians are forced behind the apartheid wall. They have no choice in this. We have the choice. We have placed ourselves behind this wall of Israeli propaganda, but we do it willingly. They can't force this on us. So, no, we're to blame for this. In the United States, where, as you can tell by my accent, where I'm originally from, in the United States, AIPAC brags about the Congress people that it has gotten rid of and replaced with its own people. They brag about this. It's all out in the open, and nobody seems bothered by this. This is our fault. You can't blame AIPAC, because we do this willingly. Nobody stops it.
Martin, you were talking earlier on, weren't you, about one of the Congress people in the States being just loads of money arriving and her being hoofed out. Because she was supporting the Palestinians.
Yes, Corrie, I can't remember her second name. Maybe Tom can help me.
Bush.
She's a sitting Democratic congresswoman, and she's lost her primary because the Israeli lobby piled money in to get rid of her and bring in somebody more acceptable to them.
Another recent one is Rashida Tlaib, a fabulous, fabulous congressperson. She was gotten rid of, and the way the Israelis are doing it now is that the millions and millions of dollars that they pour into getting rid of a progressive candidate, they don't talk about Israel or Palestine. They bring up other issues. They fabricate stories about the person they want to get rid of that do not involve Israel and Palestine, which is very clever. And the way that the laws work in the United States, this is all out in the open. This is perfectly legal. But again, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, we are to blame for allowing Israel to do this.
Yeah, we certainly are. But I mean, the thing is, we don't actually get. I mean, it seems to me that you've got the political parties, actually, Tom, that are arranging for these things to happen. I mean, this whole getting rid of Corrie was in the States was arranged by the Democratic Party. I mean, it's not by the people,
right?
Not by the voters, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, but as you know, we're on the eve of a very important U.S. presidential election. Now, every 4 years, we are in the same position of having this monopoly of two parties, which, even though they're adversarial, they have the system locked up that no third party can ever enter the realm of the possible. And I think that the public is at fault for putting up with this. The way the system works in the United States, which is extremely undemocratic, even in the way it's constructed, we always end up in this system. We are voting for the lesser of the two evils, as people always say, time and time again. And no, I'm sorry, this is extortion. Let's say that most of people that we know, we would be terrified of a Trump presidency, as I am terrified of a Trump presidency. But this is used as extortion. It's, well, you have to vote for whatever genocide-enabling war criminal we present to you, which Biden is, and which Harris is, and which Waltz is. You have to accept this, otherwise you're going to get Trump. I'm sorry, the public is at fault for putting up with this every 4 years. There should be a mass protest where everybody says, I'm going to so-called throw out my vote and vote for a third party, which would destroy the two-party system.
Yeah, well,
but it has to be at such a level. It has to be at such a level that neither of the two main parties are able to win.
Well, the independent candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has just filed paperwork to withdraw from the presidential race in the state of Arizona. The move is viewed as the first step to the 70-year-old formally pulling out of the race for the White House. He's also expected to back Donald Trump, Tom.
Yes, yes. No, to be clear, I'm not saying that there are any third-party candidates that I'm particularly excited about. Obviously, Jill Stein is the best of them, but no. We have no good third-party candidates because they know that it's not viable. Even someone like Bernie Sanders, who's hardly any radical, but okay, he would have been better than what we've been getting. Even he, a mainstream politician, was locked out of the system because he didn't fit the mold. He would have been something a bit different. Even he was locked out of the system.
Okay, so talking about the lobby, the writer Ilan Pappe, who's also here in the UK, born, I think, in Israel, he's got a book out called Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. It's just out in the last couple of months. He says he hopes for the end of Israel and the creation of a free Palestine from the river to the sea. That's one of what do you make of Ilan Pappe, Tom?
He is, in a word, fabulous. And this new book of his, which I've just begun, it's a large book, but it's worth every word. It's really the definitive analysis of this machine that keeps us slaves of the Israeli state. I highly recommend it.
Machine is the word, isn't it? It's almost had its soul sucked out. But anyway, let's have a listen to Ilan Pappe now, speaking about his book.
The insistence of every leading figure, in the Anglo-Jewish community, and also in some of the Western Jewish communities, people with status, with position, some of them ministers in cabinet, some of them important business figures in their society, I was surprised to be reminded that they made sure that everybody would understand that they themselves would never go to Palestine, that they felt safe in Britain, that they saw no reason whatsoever to create a Jewish state because they had a problem as an Anglo-Jewish community. And far worse, and most cynically, and most sinisterly, they said if there won't be a Jewish state in Palestine, the poor Jews that are subjected to anti-Semitism in Central and Eastern Europe would come to Britain. God forbid. And they would are poor. We would have to take care of them. After 1905, the sense was that these poor Jews are also Bolsheviks, so they would steal problems for Britain as a whole and the Jewish community at it. And therefore, it's quite incredible to go back to the material itself and to see it word by word written in explaining to British policymakers, German policymakers, so on, this is good for Europe because we don't want the poor East European Jews to come to the West or to the United States. When I started talking, looking for the origins of the pro-Zionist lobby in the United States. So this is important because, again, it sounds like a distant chapter in the past, but it's very much a relevant issue today, isn't it? I mean, the whole connection between the Anglo-Jewish community and Israel, and this whole walking on eggshells when we start, we begin to talk earnestly and honestly and actually against racism, not because we are racist, that you cannot be an ambassador, an ambassadress for Israel and at the same time claim that all you care is for the interests of the Anglo-Jewish community. And anybody who points out to this kind of connection is immediately branded as an anti-Semite or, in my case, as a self-hating Jew. This is something that we should not be afraid to talk about because this is very, very important. I won't mention name, but if you are familiar with what goes on in the Labour Party now, a full lobbyist for Israel is going to be one of the most powerful member of the Labour Party. I don't want to get into names. It's not important. The name is not important. What is important that for 100 years, people who were part of the organization of the lobbying for Zionism, later for Israel, also played a very important role in British politics. And so no contradiction in representing the interests of a foreign country and a foreign state and a state that commits crimes against humanity and war crimes, and at the same time serving as civil servants or politicians of Britain. Everybody says, well, when you're going into this, you are going into the territory of conspiracies, and that leads us to the old accusations of anti-Semitism against the Jews. No, this is why we write books like this. This is why we insist that this is a scholarly work, pedantic work, that is not falling into any conspiracy theories, is just examining the evidence in history to show that this is a connection that is problematic, not just for the Palestinians, but also for the Jews in Britain. And they, I think we have now a younger generation, at least of American Jews, who fully comprehend and understand this problem and fully acknowledge that this has not served well the American Jewish community to be the ambassadors and ambassadress for Israel, and they just jettisoned their connection to Zionism, and many of them feel that in order to show where they are today, they also want to take full part in the solidarity movement with the Palestinians. So not just saying Judaism is not Zionism, our Judaism puts us in the forefront in the struggle for liberation and freedom in Palestine.
So that's Ilan Pappe there, author of Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic out. Rather serendipitously, our guest Tom Suarez has just started reading that book. What do you make of what he's saying there? How would you, what would you like to add to it, Tom?
To me, this whole issue of the use of the smear of anti-Semitism in order to stifle any debate about what Israel does, to me, this is one of the most important cases in which our permissible spectrum of thought misses the point. And I'm just expanding on what Professor Pappe has just said. Now, when we know it's not even necessary to say that every time someone tries to bring up the issue of Palestine in any sort of intellectual way, in any sort of way of fairness, that obviously they are then branded an anti-Semite, and that's the end of the story. Now, the problem is not that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. That misses the mark to me. The truth, when you look at it, is that Zionism is anti-Semitic. And I think that one of the most powerful things we can do is to throw this charge back at the accusers.
Can you explain why Zionism is anti-Semitic? I mean, for a lot of people, that jars, doesn't it?
Yes, of course, because the range of thought that we've been corralled into has deliberately been thrown off the course in order to shield the Israeli state. Now, how does these? What does it mean if, in order to challenge the Israeli state, to accuse the Israeli state of a crime, that this is considered anti-Semitic? Now, what does this mean? What this means is that the Israeli state claims an intrinsic oneness with Jewish identity, which is unknown in the rest of the world with any other nation. In other words, if I were to criticize the Communist Party in China, it would never cross your mind to accuse me of being bigoted against Chinese people. This would be preposterous. Now, what Israel has done is to make this intrinsic connection that the state itself is Jewish identity. So obviously the reason for this is so that they can say that if you say XYZ, that therefore you are saying against Jews. But the fatal flaw in this argument, which should be brought out again and again and again, is that if this were the case, then according to the Israeli state, yes, it is quote unquote the Jews who are committing these crimes. Now, in other words, if it's something anti-Semitic about saying that the Israeli state is committing genocide in full view of the entire world, if we say this and we're accused of anti-Semitism, no, the anti-Semite is the person making the accusation, because they are inescapably saying that Jews are committing this genocide not because they're individuals who happen to be Jewish, but they're committing this genocide because they are Jewish. There's no escaping from this. But we've been so browbeaten that this obvious problem with their argument is not mentioned. In my view, we have to go a step further, and every time anyone who makes a perfectly reasonable, fact-based comment about the situation that the Israeli state and its henchmen do not like, and this person is accused of anti-Semitism, it's not enough to defend the person. We have to go to the full extent of the truth and throw the charge back that the accuser is committing this libel against Jews by implicitly stating that there is something about Jewish identity itself that is enabling this genocide.
Wow. Well, your writings often look at the history of all this. I think, you know, this is one of the things that I can remember back in 1990, the time of the first Gulf War. We had people like Tim Twellin on the BBC, the new Five Live, as it was, and on Radio 4 talking about the history, a lot of the background, you know, which I found absolutely riveting, listening to even just two or three minutes talking about, you know, what happened in 1948, all that, talking about the Yom Kippur War, the Six-Day War, even further back, you know, things like Allenby's campaign in the First World War. This all seems to me really crucial and really missing, and it was quite good to see Al Jazeera putting out a documentary recently about something called the Stern Gang. Now, Martin, would you like to just tell us who the Stern Gang was? And apparently it was formed literally at the time that the Second World War was starting. Like, we're talking here about September, August 1939.
Well, I mean, the term Stern Gang was reused by the British authorities. So that's what their term
was. A guy called Avraham Stern.
That's right. So they called it the Stern Gang, like the Baader-Meinhof group or whatever. Well, I believe, and perhaps Tom will correct me if I'm wrong, they call themselves the Lehi, which means jawbone, because Samson killed lots of Philistines with the jawbone of a mule, and therefore the Lehi saw themselves as, you know, a reincarnation of Samson. And of course they were very, very militantly anti the British, to the extent that they were, you know, there was documented links that they were having with the Axis powers about, you know, if we help you beat the British, will you give us a state here in Palestine? So even during when you know, the Eighth Army were facing off with the Rommel in the Western Desert, the Stern Gang, the Lehi, were killing British officials as part of their campaign to, you know, create the state of Israel.
Tom, be interesting to hear what you've got to say about this period, and if you have anything to say about the Stern Gang after we've heard the clip. But before, I wonder if you could just give us your view on the coverage of the Gaza genocide that you hear here in the UK and maybe in the US too. Because to me, in the mainstream press, what we're getting is as I said before, this kind of series of zooms in on specific incidents. Oh dear, isn't this terrible? Isn't it horrible? And of course it is, but with very, very little of the context.
The entire framework is that Israel is defending itself, and therefore all these atrocities that happen day after day after day, this is the unfortunate result of the need of the Israeli state to defend itself against Hamas. Now, what needs to be done is to refute this entire premise and go back to why October 7th happened. Now, Gaza is essentially a holding camp for Palestinian non-Jews who were thrown off their land because they're not Jewish, and there's no other reason, the Nakba of 1948, the only sole reason why these people were ethnically cleansed is that they were not Jewish. End of story. Now, so here they are in Gaza, and they have every right all along through all these years, they have the right to go home. But the reason they don't go home is not that they need Israeli permission, but because Israel blocks them. There's a big difference. They don't need anybody's permission to go home, but they are in these containment camps all these decades. And any nonviolent means simply to bring the world's attention to the situation. There was the famous March of Return a few years ago, where Israeli snipers, in absolutely no threat to them, killed about 200 of these people and crippled many, many more. These people were doing nothing more than a benign show of protest. They were behind this so-called fence, which they cannot possibly get past. So this whole idea that there is any way for the people in Gaza, through any normal means, to bring the world's attention to this ongoing injustice is demonstrably false. Eventually, this was going to blow up. And it did. And the world acts shocked. How can this happen? Now, whatever happened on October 7th on the other side of the barrier, there, of course, is a lot of disagreement about just what happened. But I don't think that Hamas expected to have the free reign that they did. I think that it was very strange that they got to the other side of the barrier and the IDF was essentially asleep at the wheel. But whatever the case, we have to fight this idea that Israel is defending itself. It is not. Defending itself would be if everybody in Gaza were able to go to their own legal, rightful homes in what is the land now under the control of the Israeli state, and this entire situation would never have happened.
Well, look, a right to return for one lot, but not the other lot, apparently. Anyway, let's have a listen now to an extract from this documentary about the Stern Gang, led by Avraham Stern, from Al Jazeera, where he really talks about the very earliest days of the violent uprising, which we would probably now call terrorist uprising against the British in Palestine.
The end of August 1939, just the day before the Second World War began, the British CID captured all the heads of the Irgun in a department in Tel Aviv. And a few months before, they captured the head of the Irgun, David Raziel. And also, on the same day when the Germans began the war, Zev Jabotinsky decided that now the Irgun are not going to fight the British until the end of the war. And then Avraham Shteren, with some of his friends, disagree with the Jabotinsky decision, and they're going to fight the British. So Shteren decided that he's going to split from the Irgun and to establish his own group, which is called the Shteren Group. And if you want to establish a group, you need three things. You need men, you need arms, and you need money.
So they went out robbing banks, and because they were not true professionals, people got killed. And there was a great rage from most of the Jewish population against them.
The British authorities here, and mainly the British police in Tel Aviv, they were in panic from the Lehi actions, because Lehi was killing and wounding many British soldiers, British officers. And they thought that if they will kill Stern, the underground will die with him. So there was a hunt. It's a simple story. Two of his soldiers were injured and being treated in a Jaffa hospital. And one day, the mother of one of the injured came to visit, and she told the other one, his name was Moshe Svorai, that she wants to go and visit his wife, but she doesn't know the address. And he told her the address in Hebrew.
And Svorai's wife, in the most naive and probably not a very professional conduct, was giving shelter to Stern. And when this information was tracked down by the British intelligence, the next thing they would do was to go and see what's going on there.
The one that discovered him was an officer named Thomas Wilkin. But he didn't shoot. He called his superior, this guy, Major Morton. And Morton did the killing. My father was tied in his hands. And it was a cold blood murder. And then they claimed that he tried to run away or something.
So that's, you might be interested to hear, not the same Morton as Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary and involved with deals with the Nazis. It was a different Morton. What do you make of this? It's an interesting organisation, and people, very, very few people realise that actually, as Martin was intimating earlier, Tom, that they basically were on the same side of the Nazis fighting the British through the war.
The reason that Lehi, the Stern gang, the reason it came to be, as Martin was saying, is that at the beginning of the Second World War, both the Haganah and the Irgun decided to lay back a bit. Now, the Stern gang, Abraham Stern and the people who went with him, they felt that there was no difference between the Axis and the Allies, that they didn't care who won the war, so they saw no reason to lay back. Now, this lasted for about 2.5 years. By the middle of 1942, the Irgun and then the Haganah had the same philosophy. Now, I think in their case, it was because they began to be more confident that the Allies would win, even though it was still by no means a done deal. But certainly by mid-1943, all three of these major gangs were no longer restraining themselves, despite the fact that it interfered with the Allied struggle against the Nazis. And yes, the Irgun did try to collaborate with especially the Italian fascists. They tried to draw up an agreement, which to me the interesting part of the agreement was that if the Italian fascists won the war, that the Irgun would agree that they had the rest of the world, but that the Irgun would have a Palestine in the larger sense, the Levant. But the interesting part is that the agreement stated that if this came to be, that the Italian fascists would use their military power to ethnically cleanse Jews around the world who were not in Palestine and force them to Palestine. One point which I think is worth mentioning about that that excellent Al Jazeera video about the CERN gang is that it continues the idea that the most infamous assassination of the entire era, the assassination of Folke Bernadotte, that this was the doing of the Stern Gang. Now, I must say I disagree with this. The assassins, the people who pulled the trigger, yes, were Lehi assassins, but they were not hired. They were not working for the Stern Gang. They were working for Ben-Gurion and the Israeli government. Ben-Gurion hired them to do the job, in part because they were the virtuoso of assassins. They knew how to do the job well, and because it would keep the name of the very young Israeli state clean. But the idea that Stern's son and a few others mention on the film that the idea of the Stern Gang was to target certain people and not innocent people, this is wrong. No, there were many Jewish settlers there who were killed because they were against the fanaticism of the gang.
Wow. Gosh. It's, you know, so many echoes of Northern Ireland here, these sorts of sectarian killings and terror groups and manipulations and that sort of thing. Before we finish, I'd also like to play a clip which was on last week's podcast, but I meant to play it in the live show for those, and I do respect almost more than anyone else the live listeners. Sorry I missed this clip out. We're going to hear it again now. It was in the podcast, not in the live show, and it's about the lobby here in the UK. It's a very awkward subject, but I think it should be definitely drilled into, really, to understand how the Israel lobby took over, as he, at least he accuses here, Nick Griffin, former leader of the BNP, said that basically through the United States, the Israel lobby had moved in on the British National Party.
Over the last couple of years, there's been an immense amount of effort thrown at this party and the key individuals in this party, at various local as well as national levels, to take us over. Out of all the groups, the most important one by a mile was the English Defence League, British Freedom Party. That was a serious, systematic, hugely funded effort by a section of the ruling elite, by this Zionist neocon clique, to dominate, to simply take over nationalism and turn it into their tool to encourage the white working class to go and fight their wars, and so that when the banking collapse comes, people are looking in the wrong direction instead of the real culprits. This party, we were approached. I was approached. We were offered money from the United States. And all they wanted was two things. They only wanted us to concentrate on Islam. And I yield to no one in my criticism of Islam and grooming. I put my neck on the line. Many of you have put your neck on the line as well. But it's not the only problem. And they wanted us only to focus on that, and it only came with one other thing. They wanted us to drop our criticism of the banking system. Those were the only two things. We had to concentrate on talking about Muslims, and we had to drop our criticism of the international banking system. And I refused, and we refused. That was in about 2007. And all hell broke loose, really, from that time, when systematically they tried to take this party apart. And there's the self-same people in groups, various of the so-called Tory think tank groups and so on, things like Policy Exchange, things like the Centre for Policy Studies, the self-same people who organised and ran Nothing British to devastate the BNP's electoral chances with lies in the Sun and things like that. Those self-same people were there right at the start conspiring to create the English Defence League, then the British Freedom Party, to take real nationalism in this country and break it on the wheel and then replace it by their puppet.
So that's Nick Griffin from the BNP saying there that that this American money had come in to set both, in a way, two different things. One is to try to get the British National Party to turn into really an Islamophobic party, to start focusing on Islam, and also the setting up of the English Defence League and the British Freedom Party as counterparties. So something obviously was happening there, and I'm joined, as we have been for the last 45 minutes or so, by Thomas Suarez, author of Palestine Hijacked, How Zionism Forged an Apartheid State from the River to the Sea. What do you make of this this news, apparently, from, well, I mean, this is Nick Griffin, leader of the ex-leader of the BNP, saying these things, but it does sound as if almost everything has been kind of weaponized in the past to support efforts of the genocide that's going on now in Israel.
The claims by Nick Griffin, they don't surprise me, but in terms of the banking issue, I plead ignorance. I know nothing about that. But certainly the dehumanization of Muslims in general and Palestinians in particular is certainly not news. That's easily demonstrated.
Yeah, it's almost like, it seems to me, Martin, like the home front of a much longer battle that's been going on really since 1948.
Well, I mean, if you see David Miller, who used to be the sociology professor here at Bristol University and was forced out by the lobby, he's had some very interesting stuff up about the links between the far right in this country and the Israelis. And of course, Tommy Robinson, who is the sort of, you know, Nick Griffin's alter ego, as it were,
the doppelganger. They seem to set up something which is it and designed to sort of, yeah, you know, much better funded and
We can see this on the far right across Europe. They've gradually dropped their anti-Semitic past and now see themselves as very anti-Muslim and therefore pro-Israeli. So Tommy Robinson has been to Israel. He's undoubtedly received money from Israeli sources, which David Miller has been ferreting down. And, of course, there are pictures of him in the Golan Heights, which is actually part of Syria, although it's been annexed by Israel, prancing around with an Uzi submachine gun. And, of course, they had their big rally just before all this stuff kicked off. They had their big rally in Trafalgar Square, and they had all their people there waving, you know, English flags, Union Jacks, Israeli flags, and Ukrainian flags.
Well, it's interesting.
So you can see that the Israeli right wing are being drawn into, you know, the general right wing, you know, the anti-Semitism of the right in Europe has been much, much dialed back, and anti-Muslim sentiments are being pushed forwards, and that is definitely...
Well, I can remember there was an MP that said the Muslims are the new Jews, when he was getting targeted himself.
Well, the Zionist state works pretty hard, and there's definitely evidence to my mind, and David Miller's been looking into it, that a lot of this has been orchestrated in order to undermine the the pro-Palestinian demonstrations that we've been having.
Well,
they were going on about what the problem is. They should have banned all these pro-Palestinian demonstrations. You know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people should be banned.
Thank God. But anyway, I mean, if I can just pick up on this thing of the attempt to stop these political parties discussing the financial system. I mean, I was working for and with the Green Party in the early noughties as part of their financial policy review group. And I did a talk for them, a presentation for them about the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank up in Birmingham, I think it was. They have dropped all criticism of the financial system pretty much. The Green Party seem to have done the same. I wonder if some of the similar people came waving from the States, waving money in front of the Green Party to get them to drop those proposals as they came closer to power. But the last clip we'll hear is from a chap called Richard Medhurst this week. He's a journalist who is, he considers himself sort of an offspring of the diplomatic. He's got various diplomatic parents, or one parent who was a former diplomat and has moved in those circles for many years. But he was arrested at Heathrow Airport this week, just coming back from a trip abroad.
The investigation is still ongoing, so I was arrested and then released on bail, so I'm waiting to see if I'm going to be charged. Some people seem to be very upset with my reporting. I've tried to provide a counterweight, counterbalance to what is being said by the BBC, what is being said by the mainstream media about the Middle East throughout my journalistic career. And I think this has upset a lot of people in the political and in the media establishment. This is it's an utter political persecution. The way that I was treated is, it's borderline violation of human rights. I mean, I don't want to dramatize it, of course, but sending six police officers, one of them in, tactical gear, into the plane, half of them stepped into the plane and put me in handcuffs. I had to wait hours for water, put in a cold cell that smelled like urine. I mean, the conditions are really horrific, and I'm not just saying that because it happened to me. I'm speaking generally. No one should be in these conditions. This is the behavior that the United Kingdom constantly accuses other countries of doing. But as a matter of fact, a violation of freedom of the press and attacking journalists is a very, very real thing in England. I saw that when I covered Julian Assange's case, and now it's happening to me, albeit in a different form.
And Richard Medhurst again believes the arrests of journalists and searches of their homes has become a trend, and a very worrying one at that.
It is a trend, it's a terrifying trend, because what they're trying to do is make examples out of us in different ways. I'm going home to England, and then they use the Terrorism Act against me, or Scott he's at home in the US, and then they come and raid his house. They're afraid that people are going to listen to alternative media, to independent journalists, and free their minds, and so they want, what the British government are trying to do, and what the US government are trying to do, and Israel are trying to do is have one narrative, and anybody who diverts or diverges from that will be punished and made an example out of. And I must say something that, what happened to Scott, it really, resonated with me, because he also has sort of a similar background with the United Nations. He worked as a weapons inspector with the UN. My parents worked with the UN. We have nothing to do with terrorism. We're all from the diplomatic community. We oppose terrorism. We're against terrorism. I was a victim of terrorism when we were posted in Islamabad. The Egyptian embassy adjacent to my school, the British school, was blown up. I was there. So, the idea that Scots or that I support terrorism is ludicrous. We're the last people on earth who would support terrorism or become terrorists.
So, Tom, the lobby seems to extend quite a long way. Richard has been very critical of the Israelis, and this week, he steps off a plane. In fact, even before he'd stepped off the plane, the officers came on and arrested him.
Do you know what he said that caused this?
They haven't accused him. I don't think of anything specific, but he's just he's saying, Martin.
I understand from reading what he said is that the Terrorism Act is advocating on behalf of a proscribed organisation, to wit, Hamas. And if we're going to have a serious conversation about what's going on in the Middle East, we've got to discuss Hamas. As you said earlier, Tom, they were the elected government of Palestine.
Yeah, he doesn't have to be a cheerleader for Hamas.
No, but
he?
Of course, they're a proscribed organisation. They were proscribed by the British government not that long ago, in fact, the same as Hezbollah. And once they're a proscribed organisation, you're not allowed to advocate on their behalf because they're proscribed. That used to be the case with the Provisional IRA, was a banned organisation.
They're an elected organisation, 40,000 of people are dead now. Surely it's time to unprescribe them.
Well, I'm just saying, that's what it, that, as far as he can tell, That is what this is about.
Could we prescribe the far-right Israeli government?
We should be prescribing the Israeli government. Of course, back in the day, in the 1940s, the Irgun, the Haganah, and the Lehi were prescribed organisations. But we've accepted them now, and now they're the legitimate government of Israel.
Good question, Tom. But I know you're aching to talk about. At least I'm aching to ask you about solutions, because we could talk all day about how terrible all this is. I think what people need to know is, how do we get out of it?
You won't be surprised to know that I don't have a good answer. But what I am very confident about is that we collectively, all of us who do see what's going on and understand that we've been brainwashed by by our collective governments and mainstream media, we need at once to start speaking the truth, to start questioning the existence of the Israeli state itself. If you can't do that, then we're not going to get any place. We have been, for 76 years, we have been documenting Israeli crimes. Every time Israel commits a crime, which is every day, we expose it, we talk about it, we report it, which, of course, is absolutely necessary. But we've been doing this for 76 years, and it gets worse and worse. This doesn't change it. It's not going to change until we challenge the existence of a state predicated on racial nationalism.
So, Palestine hijacked, how Zionism forged an apartheid state from the river to the sea. Notice you put that little thing at the end there, from the river to the sea, which for some reason, this is supposed to be something you're not allowed to say because it's anti-Semitic. I bet that made you annoyed when you heard that, Thomas.
Yes, I wasn't surprised.
Yeah, because, of course, any free country, Palestine can be free. Why not? And that's what everybody wants, surely. I mean, talking of possible solutions to all of this, I was interviewed by Press TV a couple of weeks ago about Ben-Gavir and his incursion into the Al-Aqsa compound to pray. And my attitude to it was, well, you know, if the guy's going to be searched, if he's going to leave his tear gas and his guns behind, go for it. Let him in. Embrace him. Because it seems to me that the solution to a lot of this lies in the attempt to crowbar apart these various monotheistic faiths, you know, the Abrahamic faiths, and to really kind of get in between them, to get them fighting each other. And surely, yes, of course, if somebody comes along with a gun to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, then they should be stopped. But of course, they're not being stopped. A lot of the time, the Israeli police are getting in there. The idea should, it seems to me, to be encouraged. Encourage Muslims to come to the Wailing Wall and pray. Encourage Jews to come to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and pray, because this may... What do you make of that anyway, Thomas? Is that a bit pie in the sky? A bit naive of me?
I don't know if naive is the word. It's an interesting thought. Obviously, I believe that at the end of the day, the solution is for absolute, complete equality. Now, whether in the present climate, whether it's possible for Ben-Gavir to go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and go there and pray as an equal, while so many Muslims are prevented from going there. I mean, the Muslims in Gaza can't go there. Most of the Muslims in the West Bank can't go there. So I don't know that I don't believe that in the situation as it is, it's possible for Ben-Gavir to go there as an equal. No, he has privilege as an Israeli to go there, which is denied the vast majority of the Muslims in the region from the river to the sea.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm saying is that this might be a way of dividing I suppose, the Zionists who are actually full of hatred from those that are actually adhering to the faith in some way, who obviously see that as a nice reconciling gesture between the Abrahamic faiths and those that just were driven by hatred of Muslims or by anyone that's not a Zionist would not. Anyway, so that's just my part. Since you bring up this idea of possible solutions, I think we need to be talking about that. It's a far better thing. So Palestine Hijacked is the book, How Zionism Forged an Apartheid State from the River to the Sea. Thomas Suarez, how do people follow you? What's the best place to look your stuff up online or blog or whatever?
I have a website, which is thomassuarez.com, my full name, thomassuarez.com, which has links to articles and books.
Okay, Tom, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to have a break now with a little bit of music and get your dancing shoes on, folks. Hopefully this you will really enjoy some of this. It's some something from the – and anyone that says the 1970s were terrible, look, come on, we've got two songs here from the 70s.
Welcome to the revolution. We
won't be televised. Government been telling lies. If you're not with us, you better step aside. Witnessing a genocide. Everything is centralized. The food that we consume, and they spraying it out with pesticides. Easily identify the sheep and the snake, the real and the fake, giving us a reason to pray. I'ma make my own choices. A voice for the voiceless. They trying to destroy us, avoiding the poison. It's all pointless if you don't have a purpose. If you read the verses, you'll know who we versing. Government can tell you what your worth is. Look deeper than the surface. They don't even want you researching or asking questions. We all being tested. Shut your mouth, they comply, that's the message. Want you depressed on prescriptions that mess with your head. Got you stressing, suppressing expression.
We will not comply with the institution's sick illusion. No, it won't be televised. Welcome to the
power and control, that's their number one goal. All my friends turn to foes, look how easily they fold. Even Nazis say they were doing what they told. Walking down this road all alone in the cold, but my soul never sold. I'm exposing the clothes, God has chosen this role. All of those who oppose want me hopeless and broke, like I'm Noah on boats. I'm just trying to tell them all about the flood. I can feel it in my bones, I can feel it in my blood. Man, I came up out of mud, only God is my judge. I don't listen to these politicians, they the real thugs. Won't comply with the lies, they disguise it in science. They want you compliant, the media's biased. These corporate giants are capitalizing on us by dividing, but I'll keep on fighting.
That's Steely Ice Band, the lovely voice of Maddy Pryor. And from 1975, All the Hard Times. Brilliant dancing song, that, isn't it? Because it's all this, it's a bit like the blues, and then it suddenly goes All the Good Times at the end. Absolutely brilliant. And that's what I like. It's just great. It's also nationalistic. I bet you they won't play that on the BBC anymore. And also, we started, though, with the Isley Brothers. That's Harvest for the World. Instead of the hymn, I suppose. Actually, it is a bit of a hymn in a way. In the middle of all that was Hi Rez. Welcome to the Revolution. He's amazing. I first heard him opposite Downing Street blasting out. There's quite a lot of that really good. Maybe in the music after the show, we'll have a bit more of that sort of thing. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to be returning straight back to, not to Gaza, but to Ukraine, to have a listen to Ben Wallace, Martin. He's the former Defence Secretary, and he was one of the people who's deciding about whether to use these Storm Shadow missiles or not, or whether the Ukrainians were going to be allowed to, whether they were going to be trusted. In a way, the British don't have to trust them with any of this, because the British are actually operating these things, aren't they?
Yeah, the Ukrainians haven't got the skills to use the weaponry, so it's presumably British personnel are actually doing the shooting.
So let's have a listen to the Ben Wallace here on the BBC yesterday talking about the Storm Shadow missiles and whether it was appropriate to be hitting all these targets around Russia with these long-range missiles we British taxpayers are supplying.
When you authorised those Storm Shadow missiles, did you have in mind that they should not be and could not be, as a condition, used inside Russia itself?
No, not really. Remember, the first real strikes of Storm Shadow were up roughly just to the north of Crimea in that sort of main logistics supply route and some of the helicopter bases that the Russians were using to prosecute their illegal invasion. And then eventually Storm Shadows were seen being used in Crimea. And we often, all the way through this, have forgotten to look at it through the Russians' eyes. So the Russians believe Crimea is Russia. Putin famously said Crimea is Russia and Russia is Crimea. So in a sense, they've already been striking in Russia. I mean, the whole of Putin's narrative about the sort of unification is based around a strong inherent belief that people at places like Crimea is already Russia. So we didn't really take those views. We took the view, and we've always been consistent, that the only red line is international law. And Article 51 of the United Nations allows a state to defend itself, obviously, right, from an illegal invasion. And it is also allowed to take offensive action against bases that are used to prosecute that war, okay, on it.
Well, I mean, that is the position, as we know. It's the position of the previous Tory government. It's the position of the new Labour government. And, of course, that we could say that when Britain invaded Afghanistan or Iraq, the intervention we made in Libya and Syria, we were invading those countries, and therefore they would be absolutely entitled to fight back. So, for example, when we had the chemical weapons attack at Douma, which turned out to be a fake, of course, and we fired missiles into Syria from Cyprus, they would have the absolute right to fire back. And, of course,
at Cyprus or Britain?
At Cyprus. Don't forget, Akrotiri is part of Britain. It's British sovereign territory. Not that the Cypriots want it to be there. They never wanted it to be there. They tried to kick us out. They had fought a war against us to get us out. But we insist on having our base there. And, of course, that will be the obvious place that Hezbollah will attack if they are attacked from that base. But, of course, if we're going to follow Ben Wallace's argument, then British territory is absolutely fair game, isn't it? If Russian territory is fair game, British territory is fair game. All's fair in love and war.
No,
eh?
But the people doing the actual fighting are not the British, supposedly. That's what he seems to be saying. This is just Ukraine fighting Russia.
Yes, except that if they're using British missiles, the Russians will say, well, hang on, we're going to put some missiles to the Houthi. This is what they've said. They've sent stuff to Nasrallah. Say, we want you to sink a British destroyer for us. Yeah. Kill some British sailors, just as they're killing our soldiers. They've got mums and families and wives as well. We've got to kill some of your people so that you get the message. Because they seem to be thinking that they can do all of this and that the Russians and the Hezbollah and...
No, Martin, I disagree with you completely. I think they are actually looking for the provocation that is going to lead to a British destroyer sinking to the bottom of the Red Sea. That's what they're actually looking
for. That's true. And that's why the other side are not necessarily taking the bait, but I'm just talking about what's morally allowed. If we're going to talk about what's morally allowed, what's militarily or politically wise is something else. What's morally allowed, if you are going to hit civilian targets in Russia, because that's what we have been hitting, you know, the Crocus attack on the theatre.
That was the Ukrainians did that.
Yes, but the Ukrainians working with British special forces, no doubt about it. Yes,
well, maybe being trained. It's not the same.
No, it's not. It is the same thing.
No, it isn't.
All right, so it's okay. Would it have been okay in the day for the Russians to train the Prussian IRA, for example?
Well, they would have. The British would have had something to say about
that. Yeah, they would,
for sure. Anyway, is it okay to use these Storm Shadow missiles, which have been used against, in big inverted commas, Ukraine, which is occupied by Russia in places like Crimea? But is it okay to use them in Kursk?
Using those missiles to attack a base inside Russia that may be used to help the Russian invasion of Ukraine—that's okay. Using those missiles to invade Kursk region, as Ukraine is currently doing, would that be prescribed?
Well, I think that the key here is Kursk region was being used to mount attacks on Ukraine, including the airfields, which we've just heard, obviously things like glide bombs, which have been used against civilian areas. And all the way through the last sort of 2.5 years, and certainly when I was in the job, I made it very clear, both in direct communication to the Russians and indeed in our actions, that our response was calibrated, but also if Russia continued to prosecute war crimes or start targeting civilian infrastructure, breaking international law as they were doing, there would be a response. When early on in this war, after we started doing short-range anti-tank missiles, and we're talking 300 meters, handheld weapons, Russia started bombing civilian houses. That's when I authorized the Starstreak anti-aircraft short-range missile to go in, and we informed the then resident GRU Hood, or whatever he was called, in the Russian embassy, that that's why we were doing it, and we always made it clear. Storm Shadow really became more and more important as the Russians adapted to both Ukrainian capabilities and short-range weapons. They moved their headquarters and air bases further afield. And this is really as much a reflection on today's war and where it is as it was on day one.
Well, I mean, the idea that there's been a kind of steady escalation is correct. At the beginning, there was lots of questions about what we were going to supply, what they were going to get, where is it, you know. But at the same time, it's all fundamentally premised on the wrong, you know. If you start fighting with somebody, you can't say that when they fight back that they're not within their rights to fight back. They are going to fight back, and you've got to take that into account.
He's tiptoeing around international law here, hoping the Russians actually are going to obey it. Although we Brits, for example, starting an illegal war in Iraq, don't seem to bother with it very much.
Right.
You can see what he's doing here. He's saying, well, actually, we're just about okay within international law to do this.
Well, he can say that, but the Russians are going to disagree with him, aren't they?
And also, he's also saying that it's not us, that these weapons, that we're handing those weapons to the Ukrainians who are then doing this. I mean, another aspect of all of this, of course, Martin, is what we were talking about earlier, was that potentially that this is just a kind of battle of the bulge that's going on here, and that these Ukrainian soldiers may never make it back to Ukraine.
Well, that's pretty much, from a military point of view, what's going to happen. I mean, what's so delusionary here is it's not just about the wrongness of going to war with Russia about all of this, because it is wrong. There's no reason for it. The Minsk agreements could easily have been implemented, and there would no reason to have a war at all. So there's the whole question of whether we should have had one in the first place. But once you've got one, then you've got to have some kind of strategy to win. And we haven't got a strategy to win. All we're doing is throwing away the lives of Ukrainian young people, and it's going to be devastating for at least two or three generations. the population is going to be completely, many of them are going to leave if they're not dead already, and it's just a disaster for the Ukraine, and it's responsibility of fools like Ben
but
Wallace.
But it doesn't matter, it seems, if it is a disaster for Ukraine, because that seems to be the way wars are waged nowadays. It's almost like it's not actually about resources anymore, which it was in, the sort of colonial times when empires were being built. Now it seems to be just about denying territory to your opponent. Well, and that doesn't matter. If you turn the place into a complete waste ground, that doesn't matter. It's, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the American tactics in Vietnam, spraying everything with Agent Orange so no one could grow anything there.
Well, that's right. Well, in any war, you're trying to deny the enemy the territory, and you're trying to protect your own territory. But it's what's so stupid about all of this is the way politicians in the West have talked themselves into this war frenzy with Russia, and leaving aside the rights and the wrongs of it, we're in the wrong, in my view. But have you got a viable strategy to win? And the answer is no, you haven't. The Russians are always going to win a fight on their own front
doorstep.
Isn't it
a lose scenario? We keep hearing about these various wars the Americans have lost, whether it's Iraq or whatever. They always seem to lose. And the point seems to be to go in, destroy the country, smash it to bits in this really nihilistic fashion, and then just leave them to get on with it. To still hang around and make sure you take as many of the resources.
Well,
as
I mean,
you
can. Don't forget, many countries like Laos are still absolutely devastated by unexploded munitions dropped by the Americans 50 years ago. And as you say, they are prepared to destroy whole countries just to get rid of the idea that they are a good example. So Nicaragua, over many years, has been driven downwards, not because they were any major threat to the US, but just because they were a good example, and therefore they need to be made an example of. But ultimately, when you get to the big stage of wars what we're in now, where the Chinese economy is bigger than the US economy, and the productive part, there's really some very interesting stuff on Ron Unz has an article about the productive part of the Chinese economy, you know, the bits, the widget making part, is bigger than the EU, Japan and the US combined. So we've got a big service economy, lots of people selling derivatives and hairstyles, but that's not real. The real economy is actually nuts and bolts, and the Chinese are already bigger than all three of their major opponents. They would like to destroy the Chinese economy, which was what I think COVID was all about. Didn't quite work. And of course, when you're up against real peer competition, it isn't just about destroy. They would like to destroy these countries, but they can't. They're not strong enough. They're going to lose.
So in related news, four have been announced dead today in a Russian jail hostage taking. This is four prison employees have been killed after several prisoners staged a revolt in a remote Russian penal colony and took hostages. Special forces stormed the IK-19 Surovilinko facility in the southwest Volgograd region after knife-wielding prisoners who identified themselves as ISIS militants claim to have taken control of the complex.
Well, there's something like that happened in Rostov not that long ago, where, you know, what were jihadi prisoners took hostages and were killed. And, of course, the Russians are holding quite a lot of jihadi prisoners from their various conflicts that they've had with the Western-supported Islamic extremists, the ones, for example, that carried out the attack on the Crocus Theatre, who were making their way to escape to the Ukraine when they were captured by Russian special forces. You'd have thought they'd have run away to the Caucasus, wouldn't you?
Russia's National Guard said snipers shot the four attackers in the rescue operation. The attack began during a disciplinary commission meeting. Russia's Federal Penitentiary Service said in a statement the attackers were said to have slashed guards and wounded several prison staff. The FSIN said eight prison employees and four convicts had been taken hostage. Some reports in Russian media suggested the prison director and deputy director were among those seized. So, yeah, this is sort of ongoing, isn't it? Four died there. It doesn't look like any of... Oh, yes, They're not saying exactly whether it's hostages or hostage takers that died, though. Anyway, back to Ben Wallace. We've still got more from him, you lucky Martin. So the question asked by Evan Davis on PM here yesterday is, are we going to relax all the rules? And also, does it make any difference whether you're killing civilians or the military with these British weapons?
Should we just say, look, no restrictions, use these weapons however you want to use them. We know you're defending yourself. You didn't start this war. You're not really interested in holding on to Russian territory indefinitely. This is all about defending yourself. Just you decide, Ukraine. Or should we continue to say, not really very keen on you using these weapons if it isn't a military target in Russia, or if it isn't directly connected to the invasion of Ukraine?
Well, if it's not connected at all, it's against international law. You can't just pick a random airbase and the fire. So I think my view would be we should be saying to Ukraine, look, it's your war. You are sacrificing Ukrainian lives to defend, in my view, the values of Europe and ourselves. You know, we're not fighting there and losing our children and everything else. You should have the weapons to expel Russia from your territory. And if that includes firing Storm Shadows at bases in Russia that are being used to prosecute that war, then you should be able and free.
Firing at the Kremlin, not allowed. That would be...
No, that wouldn't...
That's not allowed
at all. And we've seen today a Russian ferry being hit that's been used to supply the war from the Kursk bridge area. That's been hit with a homemade Ukrainian missile, the Neptune missile. Mm. So they're perfectly capable of developing their own longer range.
Yeah.
There is one area that I think is more important, actually, than this debate, and there's a danger this debate becomes a one-way rabbit hole, is Britain, Italy and France have supplied significant supplies of Storm Shadows. That is not an endless supply. Germany has Taurus, which is exactly the same type of missile. Scholz has continually to refuse to release them. The best boost you could give Ukraine for fighting within Ukraine is Germany joins France and Italy and Britain to release those stocks and gives Ukraine a proper stock of those missiles to deal with Russians in Ukraine.
Well, I mean, even if all these missiles were supplied, and ultimately the Germans will probably have their arms twisted and will supply them, they're not going to make any difference. The Russians are, in fact, knocking out Storm Shadow teams. They're knocking out Patriot missiles. British Challenger tanks have been turned into towering infernos in the Kursk salient. Yeah. So we're all of this equipment that we're sending is not going to make the slightest bit of difference. The Russians are winning. They've got overwhelming advantages in artillery and in the air. And on the idea that by supplying in dribs and drabs more long-range missiles is going to make any difference at all to the final outcome is absurd. There's no sense to it. We're just going to... And, of course, all we're doing is antagonising the Russians. The Russians won't be defeated by any of this. They are going to win. And Ben Wallace is going... And the side he represents is going to lose. I remember him saying, when he first became Defence Minister years ago, he said, well, I used to be in the Scots Guards, and the Scots Guards kicked the backside of the Russians in the Crimean War, and I'm sure we can do it again. This is the attitude. And it's absolutely absurd.
It's the United States that's pushing this, isn't it? It's not in Britain's interest, surely.
No, Britain is also, from a Russian point of view, Britain has been particularly belligerent. Yeah. So we. Well,
With Boris.
And also with Starmer. Yeah. Starmer has taken a more belligerent line than the Americans. Mm. And that is because Britain, in fact, has got a problem with post-imperial disorder.
No, I think it's actually more Michael Hudson that the actual real root of this war is these complete economic differences. The idea of finance capitalism in the West and industrial capitalism in Russia. The idea in Russia is that, and in many other countries, of course, sane countries around the world, that when you vote, it actually means something. In this part of the world, when you vote, it actually doesn't mean anything because the financial people are controlling the politics and the press.
Well, that's true, but I mean, if we're going to move on to financial matters, let's do that. But there is an issue.
Well, it's the same. All I'm saying is that this is what's at the back of the war.
Underlying all of this True, but on the other hand, we were picking up on, we've just listened to Ben Wallace, who's a former British defence minister. Secretary. So we're talking about, yes, so we're talking about British,
interesting
the British
thing about
and the particular role of
is
of Britain
interesting
in all
to have
of
him in, not the current defence minister. It's almost as if this is a seamless thing has happened
well,
with this change of government.
There's been
no change at all.
No, there's been no change in the policy whatsoever. But of course, it's still delusionary. Britain's creation of the war in the Ukraine, because it was in fact our prime minister who bullied Zelensky not to make peace at the beginning of the war,
even though that's what he'd been elected to do.
That's right. And so we have actually, the Russians perceive,
you can't blame
Zelensky
though. Apparently he was threatened and he said, if you do make peace, we'll kill you.
That's true. But on the other hand,
a bit of a bind, isn't it?
Now what we could have done is said, well, don't worry about that, we've got your back. Sign a peace deal. And of course, if Robin Cook had been in charge, that's what would have happened. And there wouldn't have been a war at all.
Unfortunately, he fell off a mountain. Anyway, the person who's right in charge of all of this is apparently may change in the United States soon. Kamala Harris, who's the nominee for the Democratic Party. I'm not going to play. I will put the whole speech up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk for anyone that really wants to have a listen through to see if they can find anything, you know, in there. Here she is. Just to give you a flavour of the sort of thing that in her major speech that she's going, it'd be interesting to see what happens when it comes to the live TV debates between her and Trump. It really will. But here is her speech yesterday accepting the nomination for the Democrats.
The harmony between my parents did not last. When I was in elementary school, they split up. And it was mostly my mother who raised us. Before she could finally afford to buy a home, she rented a small apartment in the East Bay. In the Bay, you either live in the hills or the flatlands. We lived in the flats. A beautiful working class neighborhood of firefighters, nurses, and construction workers, all who tended their lawns with pride. My mother, she worked long hours, and like many working parents, she leaned on a trusted circle to help raise us. Mrs. Shelton, who ran the daycare below us and became a second mother. Uncle Sherman, Aunt Mary, Uncle Freddie, Auntie Chris, none of them family by blood, and all of them family by love. Family who taught us how to make gumbo, how to play chess, and sometimes even let us win. Family who loved us, believed in us, and told us we could be anything and do anything. They instilled in us the values they personified: community, faith, and the importance of treating others as you would want to be treated, with kindness, respect, and compassion. My mother was a brilliant, 5-foot-tall, brown woman with an accent. And as the eldest child, I saw how the world would sometimes treat her. But my mother never lost her cool. She was tough, courageous, a trailblazer in the fight for women's health, and she taught Maya and me a lesson that Michelle mentioned the other night. She taught us to never complain about injustice, but do something about it. Do something about it. That was my mother. And she taught us, and she also taught us, and never do anything half-assed. A direct quote.
So Kamala Harris there in an excerpt from her big speech. Well, there's a bit of foreign policy stuff, a little bit, Martin, but it's mostly, seems to me, a political speech isn't really just a kind of CV of your childhood and sort of apple pie, that sort of thing. It should be a little bit more vision in there. And, I mean, I've played you that, how do you think? I mean, she's going to give Trump a run for his money, at least, isn't she, with this emotional stuff?
Yeah, I mean, presumably, you know, she's being advised by PR people who are telling her how to, you know, to create an image of herself which contrasts with that of, you know, old white man Trump. You know, and that's probably quite, you know, she's got a reasonable chance, especially with RFK dropping out and so on. But of course, she's still absolutely committed to supplying Israel with weaponry and going to war on behalf of Israel if necessary. And there's absolutely no change there at all. And of course, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, there have been protests by pro-Palestinian forces. It's
very
not,
small.
Well, they're quite large. They've just been ignored. It's not like 1968 when everybody turned up and the police had a massive riot and beat everybody to a pulp, but that's because the pro-Palestine demonstrators are pretty disciplined. But it's still absolutely no, you cannot vote for anybody in this presidential election from either side who is going to tell the Israelis that they've got to stop killing people. And that means that there's no real democracy at all. Caitlin Johnson, who's an Australian, is pointing out how ridiculous this is. You can't say Kamala Harris is a better, kinder supporter of genocide than Trump. Genocide is genocide. And ultimately, you've got to be able to vote against people who support it. Jill Stein doesn't support it, but as we know, she's not going to win.
So we heard a little bit about eugenics earlier on. I noticed this week that the excellent, and really is excellent, interview... Neil Oliver, that's right, Neil Oliver interviewing Whitney Webb has been pulled by YouTube for being anti-Semitic. I mean, we played a little bit about Whitney talking about the Jewish mafia. Now, is it the idea that if you mention the Jewish mafia, that you must be anti-Semitic, Martin?
Well, it's become absurd, hasn't it? I mean, Meyer Lansky was the leader of the mafia in the United States. He and Sheldon Adelson and Miriam Adelson, they are casino owners in Las Vegas. Las Vegas was created by the mafia. They were integrated. Meyer Lansky was integrated with the CIA with the deep state. And he was a Jewish gangster. Doesn't mean all Jews are gangsters or that all gangsters are Jews. But Meyer Lansky was a Jewish gangster.
Anyway,
and he worked with the CIA and the FBI.
I'd just like to, in a way, to sort of rail against this disgusting criticism, censorship by YouTube, by having a listen to another clip from this. And this is where Whitney Webb, and you know, there's so much in that interview, so much excellent. I mean, it's one of the best I've ever heard, actually, looking at what's going on in the world and how to do something about it, basically, where Whitney here talks about eugenics.
This eugenics ideology that you point out is making a comeback has its antecedents in a lot of these groups in elite Britain in the early 20th century and also late 19th century and also in the United States. And they sort of came together. But a lot of influential people were members of those. So, for example, you know, the science fiction author H.G. Wells was one of these prominent eugenicists of that era. And he wrote, and stated things like, you know, eventually, when this eugenic stuff comes to fruition, the human species is going to split and you're going to have the elite who are intelligent, tall and attractive. And then the lower class is going to be these squat like goblins who are intellectually stunted and cognitively incapable of doing what they can do now. And they eat bugs. What do you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like they've been sort of leading us on this path. And I don't think it's so much that they're anti-human. They're it is anti-human in the sense that they're not anti-human in the sense about when it's applied to themselves and other elites, but people that aren't part of their club, they view, as, you know, worse than dirt. And so the idea is to sort of, shape people to become, what their twisted vision of the lower classes is, to actually become that, like, physically and mentally and emotionally. And we're being manipulated into that, unfortunately. And so this explosion of, efforts to sort of you know, genetically manipulate us and mentally manipulate us with AI, which is reaching unprecedented levels. And Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt say on their book on AI that the end result of AI is going to be the people that are dependent on it for algorithms are going to become cognitively diminished to the point that they can't live without AI. And there will be a splitting of the species, just like H.G. Wells says, into the people who are capable of understanding AI and the people who are not capable. And the people who are capable of understanding it are the people that program and develop AI or who sustain the people that program and maintain it. And then the other lower class, the people that the AI acts upon, who are becoming cognitively diminished and will be unable to understand what AI is doing to them and what is happening to them at all. And this, I mean, it's frankly very disturbing. And a lot of these groups, these eugenics groups never really went away. The earliest days of the World Economic Forum intimately tied up with the Club of Rome, which is an outgrowth of this other group called Adela, that was basically trying to take over, the entire economic landscape of Latin America. All of these Western oligarchs, trying to basically kingmake the oligarchy of Latin America during the mid 20th century, which they did quite successfully. And then they went on to create the Club of Rome. And one of the authors of the flagship paper of the Club of Rome, which was featured very prominently at the early WEF meetings, The Limits to Growth, one of the co-authors of that, a man named Dennis Meadows, is on video saying that if we can't reduce the world population to under a billion people, we must impose a scientific dictatorship that controls 8 billion people. So we either depopulate and you have freedom, or we keep population at the same level, but we impose a scientific dictatorship. I mean, they're very overt about it. And a lot of these groups continue on and are intimately involved in the sustainable development agenda. Groups like the Global Footprint Network, which shares an insane amount of board member overlap with the Club of Rome. And as I wrote, you know, in a recent piece with my colleague Mark Goodwin, who I mentioned earlier, are attempting to impose a carbon market on Latin America right now, built on the Bitcoin blockchain. And they've essentially they're focusing on the local level, the municipal level, not the national government level, getting mayors across the continent to sign over their protected areas to this group, who are going to turn these protected areas into carbon credits. And then have it be traded by all these entities that don't necessarily have these groups' interests at heart and are tied up with the Club of Rome, which is part of this group that, you know, in the 70s, along with Henry Kissinger, framed the population growth of Latin America as a national security threat to Western nations. I mean, it's absolutely mind boggling. But unfortunately, a lot of the talking points around sustainable development are framed as altruistic. And I think the reason these groups have been so successful is that they frame themselves as philanthropists and altruists, when really they are not. And they do not have our best interests at heart. And so many people are good people, but we have been too trusting. And we are being manipulated now to trust the same people that have been doing this to human society for over 100 years. And if we keep trusting them instead of ourselves and the people we know who are good people in local communities, we are in trouble. We need to stop trusting these people that are being pushed to us and we're being told are our saviors and altruists and all of this. Look at their connections and follow the money, and you will find that is not what these people are, and that is not what these people want. And unfortunately, as far as the transhumanist agenda goes, I mean, that's an effort, you know, I would argue that's because a lot of the people pushing that have really no spirituality at all and are, you know, as far as the spectrum on material and spiritual, as far to the material side as you can get. And they think they can become gods if they advance this technology enough. But they also, again, have this mentality that they will be gods and the rest of us will be serfs, and it will be the class difference won't be enforced by economics like it once was maybe in the medieval era. It will be enforced by the technology that they've designed to control and that they're making us dependent on. And the more dependent we become on it, and the less we do, and the more we're enslaved by the convenience of it and all of that, the closer we will edge to this world they are building. So it's high time to get less dependent. I'm not saying get off of it entirely if you can't for work or whatever, but it's time to think of alternatives and just even mentally disconnect a little bit. You know, there's things everyone can do.
Sounds a bit like the shock doctrine, Martin, the idea of having a big war in order to advance this whole agenda. You know, she's saying they're being, we're being edged closer and closer towards this kind of financial slavery. But obviously a war might make that a lot happen a lot quicker.
Well, yes. And of course, the thing about a war is it might be an unpredictable thing. So, you know, you might push for a war because you think you're going to win it. But then in fact, it turns out you don't win it. Which is what I think is going to happen.
Anyway, I really like her. I think she's got H.G. Wells wrong there. She's talking about him. I mean, I have this sort of weird connection with him being born in Bromley in Kent. Well, not born there, but brought up. And when we were growing up, we had this kind of nice mosaic in the market square about H.G. Wells. And obviously, you know, all young lads like their sci-fi. But when he's doing the time machine, which is where he talks about these two different classes of people in the future, when he goes into they go into the future, this, I think, I don't know, Martin, maybe I'm being a bit nitpicky, he's a kind of Orwellian sort of warning, really. He's saying, look, this is where society could go. He's not actually saying this is where it is going and it will go.
Well, H.G. Wells, like many artists, which is what he was really, even though he got a scientific background, are contradictory characters. You know, he was also, you know, an outspoken socialist.
But it was an early part of this agenda, wasn't it? It was a very early part, and it's almost like, well, lots of people had gotten on board with this before they realised where it was going, where it was heading.
Well, everybody across the political spectrum was into eugenics in the 19th century. So even the Swedish Social Democrats, who we think of as very, very kind of liberal-minded, they were into eugenics, so they were quite keen to sterilise poor people who they didn't think were bright enough to reproduce themselves as part of their socialist utopia. What happened with the Second World War and the Nazi extremism about eugenics is eugenics became discredited in mainstream discourse. But, of course, it didn't go away. Wealthy people have always thought that poor people are inferior and there should be less of them, especially if they're not working. And, you know, we are clearly better than they are. This actually goes back right back to the beginning of human civilization. This idea that the elite have, because they form relationships amongst themselves, they get intermarried and so on, they see themselves as naturally superior to their underlings. And this is just another, you know, another iteration of it with a different level of technology, but it's the same mentality.
So the Times in Scotland has been talking about Whitney Webb. I think she's doing well. It's like a backhanded compliment, isn't it? On the front page of the Scottish Times, the Whitney Webb is under attack from corporate media as they attempt to build on a narrative that she's anti-Semitic. The Times is attempting to smear Whitney Webb as anti-Semitic after discussing her research on Neil Oliver's podcast. What's ironic is that conflating Webb's research on Leslie Wexner and other organised crime-linked figures like the Bronfmans with All Jews, as the Times has done in its hatchet job, they say a hit piece, but that's not what you call them, folks. It's Webb and on Webb and Oliver is the real anti-Semitism. It's interesting to see that her popping up. In fact, it is a backhanded compliment. Whitney Webb has been a professional writer, researcher and journalist since 2016. She's written for several websites. From 2017 to 20, was a staff writer and senior investigative reporter for Mint Press News. Currently writes on her own outlet, Unlimited Hangout, and contributes to The Last American Vagabond and Mint Press News. This week, YouTube blocked a video featuring Neil Oliver and broadcaster and former television historian and Whitney Webb due to alleged anti-Semitic content. The video, which was intended for posting on YouTube, claimed that a global criminal ruling class emerged from the Jewish mob.
Well, I mean, what she does is she shows the links between the Jewish mafia and the mafia who were Jews, because not all the mafia are Jews. Many mafia people are not Jews. You know, some are ethnic Russians, some are English. The point is that the Meyer Lansky and other Jewish gangsters in the US were very heavily embedded with the CIA and the state, and they were also involved in, you know, things like the assassination of Kennedy and all the rest of it. That is actually not anti-Semitism, it's called research. where you find out who did what and try and find out who they were.
I think the idea that if you're criticising someone who is Jewish, you're criticising them because they're Jewish, is basic error, isn't it? It's a fundamental logical error.
But of course,
what that means is that no Jew can do anything that's potentially criticisable, which is just absurd.
It is absurd. And of course, it's interesting that they have decided to start attacking her, because in actual fact, the kind of research that she does and that we kind of trying to pick up,
it hurts.
Yes, it hurts. It hurts because it's actually accurate, and they know that if people get a chance to listen to it, they're going to start thinking, "Hang on a minute, there's quite a lot here that I didn't realise." And that's exactly why they started to attack her. But what was it Gandhi said years ago? First they laugh at you, then they try to stop. Then they try to discredit you, and then you win.
Yep, like David Miller. So anyway, she mentioned Mark Goodwin there, who's a co-author with her of an excellent article, which maybe we'll be discussing in a minute. The article is called "The Chain of Issuance: The People and Patents That Built the Financial Surveillance Network." So this is really digging into where has this new financial system come from. That the idea is the IMF and the World Bank, which was put together at the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of the Second World War. This has reached the end of its sell-by date, and it's time for a new financial system. And the idea is that there's a whole bunch of people for decades have been working on what that's going to look like. So that's the research that Mark Goodwin and Whitney have done in that article. But Mark is the former editor of one of the main Bitcoin magazines. So let's have a listen to him now talking about the Silicon Valley Mafia who hold the Bitcoin for the elite.
You could look at Peter Thiel as the guy who has established the company that sells your data to the government.
Yeah.
You could really look at that. And I think that, the contracts sort of speak for themselves that yes, this is, InQtel, right? Which we haven't even talked about yet. InQtel was essentially, it was the CIA basically saying, hey, the dot-com boom is happening. The 90s are happening. And we need to compete with Silicon Valley. And the way that we compete with it is by becoming it, right? And the way that we do that is by VC firms. And a lot of them are shadow VC firms, but InQtel is actually directly, the CIA affiliated venture capital firm. And InQtel specifically helped create Palantir. And Palantir's, contract was the CIA, and they fed off the CIA for an extremely long time. But so yes, they are quite literally, it's hard to say if it's, if it started in the public sector and moved into the private sector or it was a private sector from the beginning, but funded by public. It's all kind of wishy-washy and nebulous by design. Again, I would say by design. And I think this mechanism of private and public is very interesting when you understand that, okay, the CIA has created a venture capital firm. It's investing in companies like Palantir, like Chain Analysis. And then also as we're coming to the digitalization of money. So there's a lot of talk about how bad CBDCs are, which of course they are. They're not great. We don't want the government to have all this information. We don't want the government to be able to blacklist or, do a lot of these things with users' money. It's a very obvious, easy thing to see as being like an overreach of power. Mm-hmm. But people don't apply that same skepticism to private bank digital currency, which is what a lot of these, sort of stablecoin issuers are. Mm-hmm. You look at a Tether, and again, I understand a lot of people have a lot of sympathy for stablecoins in the emerging markets. It's better than inflating peso. But they've integrated the FBI, the Secret Service. They've integrated InQtel funded Chain Analysis into their platform. They're buying up U.S. debt, as much as anybody. And because they're private sector, they actually, again, retain a lot of this blacklisting ability, this restriction, this ability to seize funds, to restrict your spending, a lot of things that maybe a government issued currency couldn't do. They wouldn't maybe be able to restrict customer access, right?
Well, and if it's cash, that would be rather difficult. So that's Mark Goodwin there, co-author with Whitney Webb of that article I was telling you about, the chain of issuance, the people and patents that built the financial surveillance network. And this isn't just a surveillance network. It's also slated to be the new financial system, Martin, with central bank digital currencies, private digital currencies, and programmable money.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting what he's saying at the end there. People get so worried about the government controlling all of this, but they don't notice that the private sector has got the same sort of power. But governments, at least in theory, are accountable. Private power is not. They're not accountable to anybody. And that's why the CIA have farmed this out to the private sector. And, of course, there's a revolving door because they can say, well, it's not the government. It's just the market.
Well, the financial sector and the corporate sector was very powerful in the build-up of Nazi Germany.
Well, of course, and of course, in actual fact, private interests dominate public power. In theory, governments answerable to the people through the ballot box. So as he said, if there was a public digital currency, it would be very hard to argue that people should be excluded from it. In fact, you'd have to make it sure that everybody wasn't, and people would say, "Hang on, you can't just exclude us if it's privately run." Well. What can we do? It's just the way it works. It's the way the world works.
So I'll put a link up to the full interview with Mark Goodwin there on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But a couple of other stories. Iran's president death helicopter crash. Well, they've had a look at it, Martin. We were speculating here that might have been deliberate. The Iranian authorities have defined the helicopter crash that killed Raisi as an accident.
Well, I mean, that's for them to say. I mean, they may know that it isn't and don't want to say so, or they may be, this is genuinely what the conclusion they've come to.
Special services in Iran had subjected at least 30,000 people to checks after Raisi's death and concluded the human factor was not to blame, the source said. So what they were saying apparently was that the helicopter with the president on board was carrying two more people than safety protocols permitted. So when the pilot noticed the fog and attempted to take the helicopter to the required altitude, the helicopter lacked the power to do so. And so the two extra people on board, and the condition, I imagine he was trying to go above the fog. Mm. In the conditions of limited visibility due to the fog, a collision with a mountain took place, the source said.
Well, I mean, I hear this is the Iranians have carried out their investigation and this is what they're saying. As I say, they may have actually privately drawn other conclusions, but it might not suit their book to say so. Lots of suspicions are still out there.
No GPS systems were installed on the helicopters in line with security requirements, the source said. This means the possibility of hacking the aircraft's electronics and any attempts to tamper with them were mostly ruled out. The investigation also found no evidence of chemical or hazardous substances that could have caused the helicopter to crash. So there you have it, folks. That's the official line, but it isn't necessarily, Martin, the truth, you think, maybe?
Well, I think, you've got to take everything with a pinch of salt. But, I mean, that's what the Iranians are saying. So, let's just take it at that. That's what the Iranians are saying.
Russia is offering a safe haven for people trying to escape Western liberal ideals. Under the document, such foreign nationals will have the right to apply for temporary residence in Russia outside the quota approved by the Russian government without providing documents confirming their knowledge of the Russian language, Russian history, or basic laws. This week, Moscow's providing assistance to any foreigners who want to escape the neoliberal ideals being put forward in their country, and they can move to Russia, where traditional values reign supreme, he says.
Well, Marchanov has been talking about this on his blog all week. I mean, this is Psy War by the Russians, saying, if you don't want to live in terrible neoliberal woke Britain, why don't you come and live in Russia? The door's open for you.
Foreign nationals will have the right to apply for temporary residence in Russia outside the quota approved. Applications may be based on the rejection of their country's policies aimed at I suppose, in a way, this is like voting with your feet, isn't it?
Well, it may be that we're both going to end up in Russia once the people in this country decide that we're in persona non grata, Tony.
No, or in jail, Martin, or dead.
I'd rather go to Russia.
Well, if you've got a choice, this is the trouble. I mean, no, I want to stay here. This is where it's all happening. It's a fascinating country. It's a really interesting place to do journalism. So why would you want to go anywhere else? The news is from David Lammy. We didn't manage to really quite cover this last week, but he was over in Israel, wasn't he? He was snubbed by Netanyahu. Netanyahu didn't want to see him, although he was expecting to have a meeting with him. The meeting was pulled at the last minute for the reason that, even though it happened a few weeks ago, Britain has withdrawn its objection to the arrest warrant for Netanyahu.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, insofar as the Starmer regime has edged towards a more critical position of Israel under pressure from people like ourselves, the Israelis then say, well, we're not talking to you.
Under pressure from us?
Well, no, I mean, the movement that we have built in this country since October the 7th, okay, which, you know, several Labour MPs lost their seats,
I like
including around here.
The movement, yeah, you're right. The
and, of course, that has actually pushed the Labour government in the right direction. They're kicking and screaming, but they suddenly realise that we can't just be seen to be backing the Israelis to the hilt. But, of course, they're not allowed to criticise the Israelis. The Israelis are only interested in people who turn up to back them to the hilt. And if Lammy turns up for a chat and he's not backing us to the hilt, well, we're not talking.
Are they going to put him in his box, do you think, after this? Make sure he toes the line in future?
Well, I think what they're going to do is, that, you know, the idea that Britain...
I'm talking about the lobby here, the Israel lobby.
Yeah, well, no, because they can't... You see, what Starmer has done is his Attorney General was a liberal Zionist. And, of course, he's of a liberal Zionist persuasion. And they are hoping that because they are Zionists, they will get some kind of some kind of hearing from the current government in Israel. You know, we're very, very friendly to you, but really, could you have to kill so many children? And, of course, the answer to that from the Israelis is, yes, get stuffed. So that's the reality.
Israel says the UK is expected to take part in retaliatory strikes on Iran if Israel is attacked. Iran has threatened to take revenge on Israel after a top Hamas official was killed as Gaza ceasefire talks continue. But Israel said it expects the UK to take part in military action against Iran if it attacks them. In response, Israel said that the attack it expected its allies, including the UK, France and the US, to join in a strike back. The country's foreign minister, Israel Katz, told his British and French counterparts, David Lammy and Stéphane Séjourn, that Israel expects France and Britain to publicly clarify to Iran that it is unacceptable for it to attack Israel, and if Iran attacks, the US-led coalition will join Israel, not only to in defence, but also in an attack against significant targets in Iran. The UK and France were both part of an international coalition that helped defend Israel in April when Iran launched hundreds of missiles into the country. Lammy said following the meeting with Katz, this is a dangerous moment for the Middle East. The risk of situation spiraling out of control is rising. Any Iranian attack would have devastating consequences for the region. It's believed that 111 hostages remain in Gaza. Lammy has, one of the bits of news, which is not in this particular report, annoyingly, is that Lammy has said, no, we can't guarantee that we're going to attack Iran for you.
Well, that's what he should say, from my point of view, but I dare say we will, if it comes down to it, because we don't actually decide our own policy. It's decided by the Americans and by the Israelis, and we just eventually have to go along with it.
I mean, can we really...
Otherwise,
will we be at
happen?
War with Iran? We want to be at war with Iran and Russia at the same time, then?
Well, it looks like that's where we're going to end up. And Lebanon, of course. And, of course, people voted Labour, if they did vote Labour at the last election, because they're concerned about, you know, hospitals, schools, potholes in the road. Did we really vote for you so that we could go to war with three foreign countries, which many people don't know very much about? I mean, we're interested in these countries. Most people in Britain aren't. They do not want to go to war with these countries at all, certainly not on behalf of Israel, which everybody can see is carrying out an atrocious genocidal massacre. So we are going to go to war to defend the people who are doing that. That makes my blood boil, and it's an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars. That's all I'll say.
Both France and the UK, according to CNN, have downplayed the prospect of attacking Iran, with the UK emphasising the need to break the current destructive cycle of retaliatory violence. That's Lammy. The French foreign minister, Stéphanie Séjourn, told a press conference in Jerusalem that it would be inappropriate to speak of retaliation or preparation for an Israeli retaliation whilst diplomatic talks are underway.
Well, I think what's actually happening is because I think the axis of resistance are coordinating quite carefully here, And because negotiations are still officially going on for a ceasefire, although Hamas have basically said, you know, unless they're prepared to permanently withdraw from Gaza, there's no point discussing this. But they're not, they're waiting because of the wider public opinion in the world and in Western countries. We're waiting, and the Iranians have made this clear, if there's a ceasefire, we will not retaliate for the assassination of Haniyeh. But of course, it's becoming, you know, this game can only carry on for a little bit longer. Soon it's going to be, I'm absolutely clear, there isn't going to be a ceasefire, and at that point, the war is on. And of course, if we defend Israel, we're also getting involved in the war. If British jets are used to shoot down Iranian missiles that are coming into Israel to kill Israeli soldiers that are killing children, then we're joining in on the side of the Israelis who are killing the children.
Despite the Britain's withdrawing its objections to the arrest warrant, still no arrest warrants have been issued for Netanyahu or anyone else.
No, so in other words, this rouse behind the scenes are still going on.
I mean, this is really the triumph of the survival of the fittest over the rule of law, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's the rule of law is a very nebulous concept in this situation, isn't it? And what are the rules of warfare? Kill them first.
The rule of law.
Get their fustus with the most.
The rule of law. The idea that that the law will stop people doing war crimes, the sort of things that the Nazis did. Anyway, look, Noam Chomsky's been very ill. He's an academic that I've got a lot of respect for over the years. I remember watching his film Manufacturing Consent. The year I left the BBC and thinking, God, I wish I'd seen that before I joined the BBC, because it was a fascinating insight into the role of the media. So I'll put a link up to Manufacturing Consent on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the film. I think it's about 3 hours long, made by Canadian filmmakers and in the 1990s. Brilliant film. But anyway, here he is. He managed to come out. He was in hospital. He was very ill. I think he had a stroke or something. He's. Do you want to just say something about who he is, Martin? Because he has been a commentator for many years, hasn't he, on world events, and as well as a brilliant linguist himself.
Well, he's a professor of linguistics. There's a very
MIT.
There's a very interesting book called Decoding Chomsky, which is written by Chris Knight, who's a British academic, and he points out that what Chomsky
did he write in code.
No, decoding Chomsky.
Yeah, well, so did Chomsky write it?
Yes, well, this is what Chris Nice is arguing, is that in actual fact, a lot of his linguistic theories are actually not... the point about the linguistic theories is that they're a cover for the fact that he's actually more of a political activist trying to stop the Western deep state from doing what it's doing.
Well, linguistics is really interesting because it's what makes humans different to the animals.
And of course, that's why the book is interesting, because it actually takes it doesn't attack Chomsky's politics. It suggests that a lot of his academic stuff is actually a cover for this other stuff.
Well,
and it's a worthwhile book to read.
Sure,
I have read it.
As good as Chomsky's, I'm sure. Anyway, let's have a listen to him now talking about what he says is the future of our world. This is just the last week or so.
The U.S., which is insisting on the unipolar framework of world order, wants not only Europe, but the world to be incorporated within something like the NATO system. In fact, at its last NATO summit meeting, under U.S. pressure, NATO expanded its reach to the Indo-Pacific region. That means that NATO is now committed to taking part in the U.S. conflict with China. It's a global system. Most of the rest of the world is trying to develop a multipolar world with several independent sectors of power. So the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, Indonesia, South Africa, they want an independent source of power of their own. That's about 40% of the world economy. It's not small. Making independent relations with China, with Russia, independent of U.S. sanctions, independent of the U.S. dollar. So these are conflicts that are developing worldwide over one raging issue and one developing issue. The raging issue is the war in Ukraine. The developing issue is the U.S. conflict with China, which in the longer term is far more significant. The U.S. is, China is, of course, a second major power in the world. It's growing, developing, it's pursuing its own course, developing loan and investment and development projects throughout Eurasia, reaching to Africa, Middle East, South Asia, even to Latin America. It's now the major trading partner for Latin America, U.S., and the U.S. is determined to try to prevent Chinese economic development. The Biden administration has virtually declared kind of war with China, demanding that Western allies refuse to permit China to carry out technological development. The U.S. has sufficient control over elements of the advanced technology so that its U.S. laws now insist that others not allow China access to any technology that has any U.S. parts in it, which almost everything does because of the intricacy of international supply chains. So, for example, take, say, the Netherlands. Netherlands has the major lithographic industry, which produces critical parts for semiconductors, the source of the modern high-tech economy. Now, Netherlands has to decide whether, under U.S. demands, to lose the China market, its major market, or whether to move an independent course. Same is true for Samsung in South Korea, Japan. The world is really splintering on these lines.
Yeah, Noam Chomsky, Martin. It's interesting, he's saying, you know, he's saying Russia is a bit of a sideshow, really. The biggie is China.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that is the case. The US ruling class see the Chinese as far more of a threat because they're just economically going to overtake them. And ultimately, if we get through this next phase of World War III or IV or whatever it is, the Chinese are indeed going to dominate the 21st century because their economy is just going to be bigger than everybody else's and they're going to make the rules.
Maybe that's why the Russians are sort of have this air of confidence about what's going on in Ukraine, is that they know that the real battle is a US-China one.
Well, I think China and Russia have been forced to cooperate together because they are, and Iran, is because they're all, perceived by the deep state in the West as enemies to be got rid of. And, Kissinger has even started to hint, or in the past started to hint, that we shouldn't really be making all these people hostile to us. What we should be doing is maybe be being friendly with Iran to keep the Chinese out, or friendly with the Chinese to keep the Russians out, the kind of things he used to do.
My understanding of Kissinger is that he was absolutely up for any bit of world domination, so long as you weren't encouraging anybody that had nuclear weapons to, attack you or retaliate.
Well, I mean, I think the point about him was, I mean, his great political achievement, if you really want to call it that, is when him and Nixon went to China and pulled the Chinese into the Western camp, which very much helped to destroy the Soviet Union. Now, that required being nice to the Chinese, and one of the things they had to agree to is that they would not recognise Taiwan. They would recognise Taiwan was a historical part of China, and that was part of the deal. But, of course, now they've decided, we're going to come back and pick that bone. Even at the time we agreed that was all settled, it's not settled now. We're going to pick that bone.
It sounds a little bit like what happened in Eastern Europe. We're saying, oh, it's okay, we won't advance. And of course, then afterwards, maybe they had no intention.
Well, I mean, pale face speak with forked tongue. You know, nobody trusts a word Western politicians say because they lie and they lie and they lie and they lie. They're not agreement capable, as the Russians say.
Thank you very much. Not deal ready, as Putin says. Yeah, so thank you, Alexei Sale. Patrizia Opulenza's got a little ditty for us. Ode to the mind games, looking at the Middle East. Blinken said thinking about stopping the war. In Gaza, where pieces of bodies we saw, with Bibi said talking to sort out their mess, but Hamas a word seems causes them stress. Excuses are plenty wherever we look. Lammy a whammy on Gaza now booked. Plucky with words, all empty we see. No hope of his presence for a ceasefire shall be. Words spill out daily, oh, what a to-do. Bodies in parcels wrapped up like meat stew. These leaders are feeders for guns and more war. How do they eat? Seeing blood and the gore. Lammy, a hammy, a man clearly weak. A mouthpiece so empty, yet Zionists seek to cajole and control in any way they can as Gaza is emptied all part of their plan. The peace talks like emperor without any clothes to pacify protesters and hope that it slows the outrage, the anger from all over the world from watching mass murder on screens all unfold. A war, third world planning to cover up their tracks from agendas unfolding and jabs now death traps. While massacres, mass murder goes on every day, pray all devils involved one day for this pay. No buildings on bodies, nor homes e'er be built, when foundations are rotten and filled with blood spilt. No happiness or peace e'er be found on this land, where the devil and kinning have gone hand in hand. Thank you, Patricia. A final clip tonight is actually from, he's known as the world's best chess player, Martin. Sergei Lavrov. This is him talking about what I suppose is what Chomsky is talking about too there, and others we've been hearing from tonight, about this idea of the unipolar versus the multipolar world.
Now, when they repeat like a mantra, "We will support Ukraine for as long as it takes," I'm curious, how long will it take? Like in Afghanistan, where it took 20 years to realize that you lost, or in Iraq, where you also left. Although now you are trying to stay despite the Iraqi parliament's decision that the U.S. should withdraw its troops. Or like in Libya, where the state collapsed and now everyone is trying to piece it back together. A multipolar world is a reality. It's not something someone invented. The Chinese economy is developing powerfully and rapidly. Yes, attempts are being made to stop it. Just recently, when Chairman Xi Jinping was in France, he was not only in talks with Macron, but also with Ursula von der Leyen. Representatives of the European Union publicly stated following these negotiations that they demanded China reduce the production of high-tech goods because the West has lost its competitiveness. How does this align with the principles of a free market and fair competition? The West wants to slow down China's economy. In addition to demands to stop producing a lot of cheap and high-quality products, sanctions are being applied to slow down the technological development of China in other sectors of the economy. But there should be no doubt. The more restrictions that completely discredit the model of globalization and unity of the world economy promoted by the West, the more actively and effectively the countries against which these sanctions are applied will work and create their own technologies and products. This, of course, includes the People's Republic of China, the Russian Federation, and many others. Regarding China, it is interesting that I read a statement, I can't remember exactly now, but I think it was made by Stoltenberg. He was commenting on the military exercises that took place between China and Belarus on Belarusian territory. And he seriously, with such pathos, declared that this is a dangerous matter because China is approaching NATO. But the fact that the Americans approached China long ago, that they are surrounding China and Russia too, where all this is happening on our borders, with block structures like AUKUS and the USA, Japan, Korea, the USA and South Korea are making agreements on joint nuclear policy and much more. They are trying to split the region, to pull some countries into their ranks, into the ranks of these closed bloc structures. And NATO itself has decided to advance the infrastructure of this bloc into the Indo-Pacific region. And practical steps are already being taken. Stoltenberg stated in response to the question, "How come you always called yourselves a defensive alliance, an alliance for the protection of member countries' territories?" He says, "Yes, we remain a defensive alliance, but there are threats to our alliance."
the idea of NATO as a defensive alliance. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was driven out of the Hindu Kush by the Taliban. And, of course, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is now going to try and take on the Chinese in the South China Sea. Nobody in the developing world sees NATO as anything other than thuggish. I think he's bullies who are supporting the Israelis.
He's agreeing with me what I was saying earlier on about this Michael Hudson thing, Martin, really, is he's saying actually finance and the way governments run their finance, whether or not they have any interest in the infrastructure and whether or not there's any point in voting, that seems to be at the back of a lot of what's going on.
Well, if you think about it, Russia and China had communist revolutions. Russia had one at the end of the First World War. China had one at the end of the Second World War. Both countries went through all sorts. I mean, these revolutions were not entirely positive. They caused all kinds of problems and difficulties to the people in the countries concerned. But they had those revolutions because it's a revolution of the developing world against the developed world, against the Western imperialist world. And back in the 1970s, when the Chinese were supporting the Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army, and the Cubans with their Russian equipment went into Angola to fight the South Africans, everybody knew what was going on. It's imperialism versus the rest, and that's exactly where we're at. But of course, modern Russia and China are far more powerful in many ways than the Soviet Union and Mao's China were. And of course, this is inevitable. The West has dominated the whole planet for 500 years. They've made a complete mess of it. It's time for them to go and somebody else.
Let's say also the Skull and Bones Society at Yale University, playing its role through the years in many of these geopolitical setups, such as giving Mao his money and helping him set up bookshops back in the 1920s. So it's not in the history books.
But he did do that, didn't he?
And actually, Yale University put that in there.
Isn't
it interesting how the Yale University is actually helping Mao come to power? Why is it doing that?
Well, didn't it? Well, you are picking up Mao at that stage was actually a nationalist rather than a communist. In actual fact, if you read Zheng Cheng's book, you'll see that in actual fact he only joined the Communist
Party.
People can change, can't they? Yes, they can.
When they're bribed and they can see which way the money's going.
Don't forget that the Americans were using the Chinese in order to try and get at the Japanese, who were then their main opponents. The idea that everything is...
So that wasn't like a very good idea, was it? Because they're coming back to a third world war, aren't they?
You seem to push the line that everybody's all in this together. And there's
Don't put words in my mouth. Right. I'm saying that the Skull and Bones at Yale University and their little geopolitical games have led to what is now a situation where we're heading for World War III between America and China.
And Russia. And, of course, the big support for the Chinese Communist Party came from the Russian Communist Party.
Well, I would agree with Chomsky that in the background, the US-China battle is the big one, really. That China, in a way, is a little sideshow. Russia is a sideshow. I mean, they may well be involved in this war in the future, but it's stoking up, isn't it, US-China?
Yes. Certainly is. Okay. Of course, this battle goes across the developing world.
It certainly does.
In Africa, for example. The Chinese are pushing the Americans and the British and the French out.
They are. And in South America, actually. They're starting to make inroads there, too.
They are.
And I would say, good luck to them. It's time to sign off now. Thanks for our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Thomas Suarez, joining us live on Skype earlier on, and to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send us interviews and story tips to Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, and our email addresses. That's a good one. Your email, I usually do check my email once a week. And you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, which I'll endeavour to put out the Hasbara document this weekend. And if you can afford, if you can donate, or you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio Q UK livetheeaststone.com. Do please make live recordings if you wish. We've been streaming live from the Eastone studios in Bristol, the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5, where we're going to get a little bit more local rather than national and international. God bless. And that's what the Fourth Reich decided to withhold from you tonight. We just told you. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Between 1776 and 2019, the US carried out over 392 military interventions worldwide, killing millions in the process and condemning many millions more to a life of agony and despair. A new world is struggling to be born. A phoenix will rise from the embers of empire in Gaza.
Genocide, Joe, you terrorize souls. When your eyes close at night, how do you sleep? At night, how do you? Genocide, Joe, you better lie low. We're getting quite close at night.
The murderer, you are the terrorist, you are the criminal, a crime so devilish. Genocide, the aim, starvation is what the weapon is. America's woke president speaking like he's on sedatives. Him killed in the car, wonder what our eyes seen. You were giving interviews, slobbering on an ice cream. Man squashed by a tank, seen his inside scream. Gaza's not a strip, it's the world's biggest crime scene. Barefoot fighters, red triangles on light green. Gun fixed on Aaron Bushnell as they watched his life leave. This is for the child that asked, why us, why me? This is for the children that I see in my dreams as night leans. Bodies freezing the morbid temperature. A stain remains on the faces of all your senators. No matter where the blame is aimed, will you remember the last one? Genocide Joe, the fallen emperor.
Genocide Joe, you terrorize souls. When your eyes close at night, how do you sleep? At night, how do you? Genocide Joe, you better lie low. We're getting quite close at night.
A murderer, Trump is a murderer. Whichever way you look, political system circular. Sunak is a murderer, Starmer is a murderer. Whichever politician, the indifference is merciless. If they deprive Gaza the option of breaking free, then to me a jail cell's the most honorable place to be. Fight like Vietnamese, fight like Algerians. Genocide streaming, you can share the experience. Camp David, Oslo Accords, a Trojan horse. Gaza genocide, the last gasp of the global north. They watch from the drones and they kill them with no remorse. You'll never know the hopeless thoughts as you hold a corpse. As night leans, bodies freeze in the morbid temperature. Stain remains on the faces of all your senators. No matter where the blame is aimed, we all remember the last one. Genocide Joe, the fallen emperor.
Genocide Joe, you terrorize souls. When your eyes close at night, how do you sleep? At night, how do you? Genocide Joe, you better lie low. We're getting quite close at night. We feel you breathe.
We know that it's very bleak, it's very dark, there's no way out. If there's no water, there is no way out of Gaza. What should we do? Like, drown? Like, commit mass suicide? Is this what Israel wants? And we're not going to do that. And I was telling some friend the other day that I'm an academic. Probably the toughest thing I have at home is an Expo marker. But if the Israelis invade, if they barge at us, charge at us, open door to door, to massacre us, I'm going to use that marker, throw it at the Israeli soldiers, even if that is the last thing that I would be able to do. And this is the feeling of everybody. We are helpless. We have nothing to lose.
Tei Christus es natus, ex Maria Virginei, Gaudete, Gaudete, Gaudete. Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mega Vete.
Deposades gratiae hoc quod optabamus, Carmine latitiae devoti redamus.
Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete.
Deus homo factus est natura mirante, mundus renovatus est per Christo regnante.
Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete.
Nese celis puta clausa per transita, unde lux est tota salus infinita.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete.
Ego nostro cantio, salutiam in nostro, benedicat Domino, salus regi nostro.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgin Mei, Gaudete.